Good morning. I'm going to call the Tax Committee to order, and even though we don't have a quorum yet, we're going to get started because we have a lot to do this week, and members aren't used to coming at 9 o'clock. We're normally a 10:30 committee. But we can't move these bills, but after these authors leave, when we have a quorum, we're going to move them, and I guess not the Rukavina bill, because we're hearing his information only. But the Pawlowski bill, we'll just move it and lay it over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Public Finance bill. So when we have a quorum, we'll make sure we'll do that. So, Representative Rukavina, you want to tell us about House File 480?
Well, Madam Chair, basically the bill is needed by Mountain Iron, which has developed a seabed project under current law, but in order to take advantage of the federal tax breaks, you have to be a private business. That's one of the things in the bill. And so to do that, we had to form a limited liability corporation. And so that's part of the bill. We also agreed with the electrical utilities that we would only sell it wholesale. And then we needed some language that allowed the project, the Economic Development Authority, to have a project outside their city limits. So basically that's the bill, and I think that Representative Pawlowski's bill was basically, after I had presented mine earlier this session in the Energy Committee, drafted exactly the same way for Winona.
Okay, so Representative Rukavina, since we're hearing yours informationally only, we don't have to do anything, but so members know and we're clear on the record, we're planning on putting this bill in the public finance bill, though, which will be after the omnibus tax bill. We'll put all the public finance bills in there. We wanted to hear it so we could get it in there, and I understand you're hoping to have it in true Ranger form, carry it somewhere else as well, but we want to get it in the public finance bill. Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, it already is in another omnibus bill.
Yes.
I appreciate it being in the other one, because I was told that Senator Bach had moved Senator Tomasoni's into the public finance bill,
right.
And then Representative Pawlowski told me the same, that you had requested it after you heard it, so I asked it to be referred here to you.
Yes.
Also.
Okay, so thanks for that. So we're done with House File 480. Thank you, Representative Rukavina. And Ms. Manzi's here, by the way, so if you want to catch her. And we don't quite have a quorum, Representative Pawlowski, but we do want to talk about House File 1251, and our intention would be the same, is to put this in the Omnibus Public Finance Bill as well.
Madam Chair.
Representative Pawlowski.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is a project started in 2005 by the Winona County Economic Development Authority with the $200,000 grant. It's proceeded up to this point, and we've run into the same problems and hopefully solutions that Representative Rukavina did. So the language is almost identical except for the area of the state.
Okay. Questions from members on Representative Pawlowski's bill? Is there anyone in the public, because we actually are going to move and lay this one over, and we have possession of this one. Is anyone from the public who would like to testify for or against this bill? Yes, please come down. And again, the Senate Tax Committee is hearing this bill there, so we want to make sure that we hear all the companions here, and we'll have them in the Omnibus Public Finance Bill, which, as members know, may or may not end up in the Omnibus Tax Bill at a later time, but we intend to carry them separately if we can. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Linda Grover, and I'm the Economic Development Authority Director in Winona County. As Representative Pawlowski indicated, we have been working on this project since 2005. We've examined all of the other potential ownership models and feel that this provides the maximum benefit to the county while minimizing the risks. So I'm here primarily to answer specific questions if you have any, but I wanted to make sure that you knew that we've examined all the other options.
Questions for Ms. Grover? Thank you for being here this morning, and we appreciate the being punctual. Get the bill out of the way. Anyone else from the public who would like to testify for or against House File 1251? Yes, please. Welcome. Thank you, Ms. Grover. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Chris Ng. I'm the Executive Director of the Chisago County Economic Development Authority and also the President of the Minnesota Association of Professional County Economic Developers. And I also want to speak in favor of this bill. As I mentioned to you last week, we're working on one of the first carbon-negative bio-business parks in the state of Minnesota in our county, and we hope to also have the opportunity to form limited liability corporations as we go forward with our efforts to develop the carbon-negative bio-business park. And so, again, I would like to support this bill and speak in favor of it, and if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Ng? If not, thank you as well for taking time to be here this morning. We appreciate it. Further public testimony for or against House File 1251. Questions from committee members? If not, Representative Pawlowski, thanks for being here. When we get a quorum, we'll move it, and then we'll just lay it over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Representative Pawlowski, for being here this morning. Representative Severson, another person who came on time and gets to get out of here early. So Representative Severson still don't have a quorum, but we're going to hear House File 2280. This is the Stark Rapids TIF bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thanks for taking the bill up in such short notice as well. My people are on their way. They got stuck in traffic, but I'll try and give you the best rendition I can of this bill. About three years ago, Stark Rapids went through a huge makeup. We put in a bridge that has changed the entire downtown and ended up using downtown impact mitigation in a joint state and federal project that has changed the face of Stock Rapids. A lot of the businesses were displaced as a result of that huge endeavor. And so we have a significant amount of TIF provisions in this provision, but those run out, unfortunately, in a short order. What this bill basically does is it extends the ability for us to get them into the TIF financing and extends the provision that basically was going to be cut off to them so that the town could not offer that to the incoming businesses. This is also subject to approval of the local city council as well, but it creates an incentive for the businesses to come down and migrate into the newly developed downtown area. And I'd be open for questions.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Severson, Representative Lanning, Representative Reinert, Representative Demmer, myself are the subcommittee working group on TIF here, and yours kind of came in late, so we're going to be looking at yours further today. I think we've gone through most of them, but yours, so we'll be meeting on them later today. And so if your folks do come and they have any information, can you get it to me or to Representative Lanning or Mr. Michael or whatever, and then we're not sure when we're going to fit this into our calendar today, but we'll be looking at it in a more detailed way.
Yes, ma'am. You know, I know that she had that.
I think your testifiers maybe are here. Welcome. Oh. Please join us.
Hey.
Perfect timing. So, welcome to the committee. Did you want to tell us a little bit about Representative Severson's bill and introduce yourself for the tape so we know who you are?
Thank you very much.
Sure, let's catch your breath. We heard you were in traffic. You know, we're used to meeting at 10:30, so members are not used to being here at 9, so they're late too. Don't worry about it.
I'm Todd Schultz. I'm the Community Development Director for the City of Stock Rapids. And I'm Ross Olson. I'm the City Administrator, HRA Executive Director for the City of Stock Rapids.
Okay, thank you. Yes, please.
We're just going to read a little bit from the questionnaire that was put together for this. We think that it articulates essentially what we're looking for, asking the committee to consider. The proposed project involves redevelopment of a large area of downtown Stock Rapids that was affected by construction of the Stock Rapids / Kearns County Bridge over the Mississippi River, which was recently completed after numerous years of planning and construction. The bridge project included the demolition of a substantial portion of the City of Stock Rapids downtown properties and the relocation of 20% of downtown businesses. Core commercial businesses were relocated from Benton Drive, the main street of the city, to accommodate the bridge construction. As the project is drawn to completion, several sites remain at the bridge landing and in the bridge project area that are in need of redevelopment. These sites previously contained a variety of structurally substandard buildings, as defined in Minnesota statutes, that were demolished prior to or as a part of the bridge construction. Prior to their demolition, the City's Housing and Redevelopment Authority, by resolution, determined that these buildings were substandard and in need of substantial renovation or clearance. By the same resolution, the HRA expressed its intention to create a redevelopment project and potentially form a redevelopment or renewal and renovation tax increment financing district to assess the city in redeveloping these sites after the bridge project was completed. This process, which is permitted under Section 469.174, Subdivision 10D, allows an authority to treat these parcels as occupied by substandard buildings even after they have been demolished, so long as they are included in a tax increment financing district that is filed for certification within 3 years after demolition. Timing of bridge construction and limits on the city's ability to convey the impacted sites immediately after bridge construction, however, led to these properties remaining undeveloped for a period longer than had originally been anticipated. In other words, demolition was required to begin the bridge project, but redevelopment of that area could not realistically begin until the bridge project was completed. The HRA now desires to assist in the redevelopment of these sites with a 3-year statutory time limit for the HRA to act on its prior resolution by creating the TIF district has expired for reasons beyond its control. The city, along with its HRA, now needs an extension of the time limit found in Minnesota statutes, Chapter 469.174, Subdivision 10, D1, to complete its redevelopment work in downtown Sauk Rapids. If given this opportunity, the city will be able to take a major step for downtown redevelopment post-project construction, while at the same time increasing property tax base and increasing job opportunities. Total project costs, amounts of tax increment revenue, other local funds, and related questions will depend on the redevelopment proposals that come forward in the next 3 years.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Did you have further, Mr. Olson, that you want to add to the public testimony?
No, actually, I don't have any additional information. That pretty much sums up what we want to do. We just really want the 3 years that is normally allowed under state law to go through this redevelopment process that, unfortunately for us, fortunate for Central Minnesota, due to this wonderful regional transportation project, we just weren't able, as you will see through some of the photographs, due to construction material. It's tough to redevelop a site when it's filled with bulldozers and cranes and construction type of equipment. It makes it very difficult to develop that property, the HRA, and create that TIF district. So really all we're asking today is for those 3 years to be able to do that, that truly we were denied due to that important regional project.
Okay, and before you came in, I should tell you, we asked Rep. Sensaverson to give us any information that he received later in the day, and now we've got it, so we're good with that. And I also explained that there's a subcommittee of this committee that works on TIF, Rep. Lanning, myself, Rep. Dammer, and Reiner, and we're going to be discussing this further today, and so I certainly won't speak for them, but this one seems, from my personal perspective, seems pretty straightforward and probably not a big deal, but if you want to be in communication maybe with Rep. Lanning and then Reiner and Dammer, if you have further thoughts, we'd be interested in hearing about it. So, is there any further public testimony on this bill? Questions from committee members? Rep. Lanning.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just for clarification, is the bridge and all of the road access, is that covered with other funding? The TIF is not going to be used for that. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, absolutely not. No. Any tax increment financing that would be created as a result of a redevelopment effort would only be used for those eligible redevelopment expenses for that particular project. It would have nothing to do with the bridge project or the transportation roadways that accompany and accommodate the bridge. This, it really truly has nothing to do with the bridge other than the fact that that project prevented us from actually taking those important steps forward until today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? If not, we really appreciate you being here and timing that perfectly so you got your testimony in, and we need one more person for a quorum. When they walk in, we'll move this, and then we'll lay it over for possible inclusion on the second. Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This actually, the bridge that you see on the diagram there is pretty fortuitous because just last year we had the St. Cloud Bridge went up. This has been a mainstay in getting the east-to-west connector, so this was a huge regional project. And we'd just like to be able to kind of heal from that project as we're going forward.
Okay, thank you so much. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Representative Garofalo, Representative Gardner. You ready?
Yeah.
And then I see Representative Hansen's in the room. So if we can get to him, then we'll do Representative Hansen after Representative Gardner.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Okay. I assume we don't still have a quorum yet.
We're still looking for one. And Representative Gardner, you probably know that we've had a big debate about whether or not we should hear this bill, because we had a little confusion if it cost money or not, and then we kind of learned out it was actually an environmental finance bill, but it was sent directly to taxes. So we want to at least hear it and lay it over so that Representative Wagenius, I guess, would be able to hear it in the future.
Certainly.
Representative Gardner.
Oh, thank you. Madam Chair, House File 1118. Has to do with the solid waste management tax. The solid waste management tax has gone through various iterations over the last 20 years, but the crux of it is that you all pay on your garbage bill, whether you're a business or a resident of a home, into the several different places. The solid waste management tax is 9.75% on your residential garbage bill and 17% on your business garbage bill. Some of that money goes to the general fund. 30% of it goes to the general fund, which is kind of a source of perennial irritation for folks in the waste industry. But 70% of it goes to the environment fund. And from that, some of that dollar amount goes to counties as what's called SCORE grants. SCORE stands for Governor Perpich's Select Committee on Recycling and Environment. SCORE grants are prorated according to population to counties. They help pay for things like recycling your old paint, among other things. We had a lot of discussion about that last year, as well as providing drop-off locations for recycling and other waste materials. Here in the metro, the amount of money is fairly large because the population is large, but in rural counties, the amount is fairly modest. However, the amount of money going to counties during the last 20 years has stayed about the same. And over time, inflation has taken hold and the value of that money has just been reduced significantly. One of our original plans last year was to have a bill to recover the 30% of this money that actually stays in the general fund and use it for environmental purposes, and I think that's where some of the confusion was, that we were trying to recoup that, and I think that was part of the reason for the confusion. What we are focusing on is the 70% of the dollars which go to the Environment Fund, which is administered by the MPCA, and what we're asking is to capture the growth of the solid waste tax revenue going into the Environment Fund and dedicating that to counties. The solid waste management tax, I have to tell you, Madam Chair and members, has been kind of a cash cow for other people to use. It's one of the most, it's the largest source of funds, I think, of any environmental fee or tax that's going into the state because it's such a large figure. About half the money, roughly, is going to clean up old landfills, just so you know what it's used for. And some of it goes to what used to be the Office of Environmental Assistance, which is now part of the Pollution Control Agency, for grants and other remediation activities and environmental assistance activities, and then we have about $14 million going to counties. I did just find out in the Representative Bougini's omnibus bill, this paper still warm, that $14,500,000 will go to SCORE for the next fiscal year. But I have Mr. Randy Kaiser from Hennepin County who can explain a little bit. He's with the Solid Waste Management or Solid Waste Administrators Association as well.
Okay, before we go to Mr. Kaiser, if I may, now we've got a quorum, so we want to catch up here. We heard House File 480 members who are keeping track, and that was informationally only. So now Representative Marquardt moves House File 1251. We heard that, took public testimony. We're going to lay that over for possible inclusion. And then we heard Representative Severson. So Representative Broad moves House File 2280. For Representative Severson's TIF bill, we're going to lay that over for possible inclusion. And now Representative Solberg moves. Oh, Representative Gardner is a member of the committee, yes. And Representative Gardner moves House File 1118. Okay, so now it's before us. Mr. Kaiser, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Kaiser. I'm here on behalf of the State Solid Waste Administrator Association. They have representatives from pretty much all 87 counties. And like Representative Gardner said, I'd like to emphasize that this amendment to Section 297H, it's not a spending bill, and it does not take any money from the general fund. As Representative Gardner said, it captures the growth of the state solid waste management tax that you pay on your garbage bill. And what it would do is allow the MPCA to appropriate that money to the SCORE program. That money, SCORE was originally started in 1990, and it started with $15 million dedicated to counties to help them reduce waste, increase recycling, and also handle household hazardous waste. So the appropriation for the next fiscal year is $15.5 million. As recently as a few years ago, it was down to, I think, $11.5 million. So since what counties were charged to do in 1990, almost 20 years ago, we have not received any additional funding at all. It's basically stayed flat. I know some counties in these times look at taking money from general fund or other purposes to supplement what they have been putting into, but the reality is that in these days, programs might be cut and we'll probably, hopefully not lose any ground on recycling and waste reduction. But our goal is to, if people are paying the tax on their trash, that was a good part of it meant to increase recycling and waste reduction, we'd like to see the growth in that tax help fund future growth in these programs.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify for or against this bill? Questions for committee members? Okay, so Representative Gardner, I guess we're going to lay it over for a pause. Excuse me, Representative.
Madam Chair, just a comment. I think the witness said that this would allow the appropriation. If you read the language, it's mandatory. So it doesn't, it says must be appropriated, and so it takes away the discretion. that currently exists. And so I just want the record to be clear that that's what the bill does. And I might have misheard the testimony wrong, and I apologize if I did. But
no, I think I misspoke, Representative. It would require them to spend 70% mm-hmm. of that, or okay. at a minimum. So
okay, thank you. Thank you for pointing that, Representative. Representative Garner.
Madam Chair, just one final comment. And looking at the revenue estimate, we'd see the growth of dollars to counties in 2010 to 14,000 or 14,175,000 and 14,600 and so on. And I just, if Representative Levine's delete all amendment becomes the omnibus environmental finance bill, I think we're okay for this year and holding it over, because she's actually allocating a little bit more than we would get through this bill for this fiscal year. And so I guess what I just talked to staff about a few minutes ago is that we'd lay this over, and Representative Levine's would hear this as part of her deliberations for next year. But I just wanted to get the issues of there on the table, and also just remind folks it's still 30% of solid waste tax revenue is still staying in the general fund, and as far as we know, not going for any environmental purpose.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Thank you, Representative Gardner. We're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And thank you, Mr. Kaiser, for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hansen, we saw him. He's got a couple. And Representative Hansen, I don't know which one you want to take first. You know, can we hold up a minute here? I just received a note, and this is true. I'll just put this to the committee. Representative Gardner's bill that we just heard, you know, if we lay it over and just keep it here until next year, it remains a possession of the tax committee. But we'd have to, first thing next year, we'd have to send it to Representative Levinas. It's really an environment finance bill. Do folks want to just vote it out here right now to environment finance, or I guess the proper motion would be back to finance, or do you want to just keep it here? We can go either way here. It confuses people, I think, maybe at the beginning of next year. Everyone has to get reminded kind of about the bill. And so do people have thoughts on how you want to proceed with Representative Gardner's bill? Representative
Cole. Madam Chair, it would be my preference to keep it here. I've been frequently pointing out on the floor that the majority doesn't seem to have a problem moving bills around from committee to committee. So if we have to do it next year, it shouldn't be a problem to take care of it.
Well, you know, and I hear you there, Representative Cole. I think what's different in this one is, you know, we normally don't send things out. We did for Representative Schimansky, and he's passed that bill, and we did for Representative Solberg. That is a rarity. This bill would not need to be heard by us again, though, in this biennium, and it really is an environment finance spending item. So I think it's a little unique, and quite honestly, I'm not sure why it was sent directly from introduction to us. That's how we got it. I think this is the first stop. So, I mean, other thoughts, Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually think that it probably should go to the committee that it more appropriately belongs, and we certainly want issues like this to get full hearings, and if they're going to do any interim hearings or anything, we'd certainly like it to be in the possession of the committee so they can do their work.
Other thoughts from members, one way or another? Representative Garner, you want to, you kind of step back there for a second. We're now sort of debating if we should just move you on to environment finance. You made the motion for laying over. Do you want to amend your motion, or what do you think?
Yes, if we could amend the motion and send it to finance as a recommendation of good environmental finance, and Representative Virginius, if she wants, could have a more thorough discussion during the interim or any other time.
Okay, and then Representative Garner, I'm going to ask Representative Solberg or someone else here who knows, since we don't send bills to other committees normally, that's very rare, do we send this to finance to get it to Representative Virginius, or do we send it to environment finance?
Madam Chair, your proper motion would be to send it to finance. Would be reported on the blue sheet, and finance, and finance would distribute it to the environmental committee, since finance is part of environment is part of finance.
So, Representative Garner, do you want to amend your motion to send your bill to finance?
I would, Madam Chair.
Okay, so Representative Garner now moves to send House Bill 1118 to finance. Discussion of the amendment. Representative Cole, further, or Representative Broad?
Thank you. Thank you. Sorry, I almost broke that. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just kind of curious why it was sent to taxes in the first place. Can you remind me again? You said it, but I'm trying to remember.
It had the word taxes in it, Madam Chair.
Representative, I'm not really sure. I think it's just because it has tax in the title.
Right, and Madam Chair and Representative Gardner, that's why it probably is appropriate to stay here. Will we end up getting a piece of it back? I mean, it is a tax that we're dealing with. It's just a matter of that they're aligning or encumbering the tax, but it is a tax provision, so I'm curious why it wouldn't go in the tax committee versus go in the environment committee. I can understand why they'd want to have a discussion about it, but it seems to me that it does relate to a tax and ought to be in your bill or any bill, whether it's next year or the year after or 10 years from now. So I guess I'm confused at why just because it's encumbering something doesn't mean it's not a tax provision.
Okay, Rep. Sembrot, and I kind of had the same, there were some emails going back and forth yesterday internally. We were trying to figure this out, and I guess I initially thought just how you're thinking about it, but it's a spending item, it's a finance item, in that, I guess the parallel in my head is, okay, the voters passed the 3A's tax. The Outdoor Heritage Group is figuring out who's getting the money from the tax. I think his bill is figuring out who's getting the money. So it's kind of the same thing. So that 3A's tax, for all the money that the Outdoor Heritage Group is spending on, that's not coming to us. And so revenues that are coming out of taxes are being determined by finance chairs. So it is kind of confusing. I'm just going to ask Mr. Michael, if I can, who's probably not even aware I'm going to answer. Mr. Michael, can you help both me and Rep. Sembrot and everyone else here kind of think through if we should keep this here or send it off? Is it a finance item or a tax item? Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I guess the only advice that I can give you is that the rule requires, and I don't have the rule in front of me, that the rule requires matters that relate to tax policy and tax and revenues related to taxes to come to this committee. So in terms of the committee's mandatory jurisdiction, since this really doesn't make any change in tax policy, it simply attempts to direct by statute how the legislature will appropriate monies from this tax. It doesn't really relate to tax policy per se or the amount of revenues that the state's going to collect. On the other hand, I know that in the past, changes in deposit provisions, which may be analogous to this, have come to the taxes committee. So, what the House rule says has to come to tax committee doesn't always match up with what does come to tax committee.
And I guess I'd add further, now it has come to tax committee. So we've certainly met that rule. So here it is. We've moved it. We've heard it. We've taken public testimony. But the question is, what's next? Rep. Sembrot.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wouldn't suggest that the process hasn't worked so far. So, the question I have is if the Environment Committee were to get creative and decide that more of this money ought to go to the general fund than just dealing with the encumbrance piece of your bill, it would seem to me then, as the Chair, you would demand this bill come back. Is that a fair assumption if they were to get creative?
I think, Representative Brown, that's exactly right. I think if next year, then they would get the possessionist bill. I don't think they could use it this year. If next year, Representative Venus committee then did that, that bill coming back would need to go through this committee and would be, if she made that change in her omnibus bill next year, then we would have to see it for it to continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just a follow-up then. So you're very certain, Representative Gardner, that this or provisions of this would not be amended in any way into the Environment Finance Bill this year. The assumption I'm hearing from you is that no action on this provision would be taken this year, it would be taken next year. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, the thought hadn't occurred to me until this morning, but as I mentioned, the revenue estimate actually is not as good as what Representative Guinness is going to do anyway for this next fiscal year anyway. So, I mean, it would be kind of counterintuitive for me to do it for this fiscal year, but if you're looking for a pledge, I can certainly tell you that I'll mention it to Representative Guinness, and I think she knows that if anybody's changing the allocation between the general and environment fund, that it would have to come here, but I certainly can check with her. But I don't have any nefarious purpose, Representative Broad, to try and attach this, because I'm getting everything I want anyway in the Environmental Finance Bill.
Wow.
Representative Rod.
I thought I'd be fun.
In that case, maybe you'd want to attach it to something else.
No.
Wow. Actually, I'm fine, Madam Chair,
okay.
Moving it along.
Okay. Further discussion. Okay. If not, we'll take a vote to move this bill along to refer it to the Finance Committee. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Gardner.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It.
I hope I haven't set up a slippery slope.
No, well, I think Representative Solberg already and Shemansky already started that this year. So we're going to blame them. Representative Hansen, welcome. Sorry for the little delay there, but the note came up and we thought we'd try to get it where it needs to go. Representative Hansen, which bill do you want to take first?
1798.
Okay, so Representative Coonan moves House Bill 1798 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. You actually have heard 1798 very briefly on March 17th during the Green Acres Marathon hearing. And since that time, I've worked with some of the interested parties, and we've made, I do have a delete all that I think will help clarify some of the intent on 1798.
Okay, so to get in there, Representative Hansen wants, Representative Coonan moves House H1798DE1. Discussion to the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. So the amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, now, you want to explain it to us with your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. What 1798 as amended does is it takes some of these tax benefit programs and it takes the concept of cross-compliance. Those of you who are familiar with agricultural programs at the federal level, there's a cross-compliance often where if you break the compliance, you lose the benefit. That's the concept I'm looking at here, is taking cross-compliance. If there's a violation of statute in the agricultural or the environmental area, then you lose the tax benefit. I believe that these preferential tax benefits, whether they're in agricultural preserves or green acres, are designed for a public purpose, and they have a need where you are trying to have a benefit. But they are a privilege, not a right. And so if you have a violation of the statute, you would lose that eligibility and be required to pay back. And what the amendment does, in the earlier bill, it had to pay back all the way back to the beginning. What the amendment has done is make that a 7-year limit. It's also clarified some of the requirements relating to administrative penalties. It's not my intent that a warning letter would be something that trips you into losing that eligibility. But during much of the debate in the past year and a half, we've heard things about draining wetlands, doing things that there are laws. We have laws that we've debated extensively in Minnesota, and that when folks are receiving these tax benefits for a public purpose, I think that this cross-compliance provides another protection to the public for that investment in terms of achieving those goals for environmental or agricultural protection. So that's my intent. I have yesterday was not a full day at the Capitol. I've received a few more comments overnight, but we've tried to include some of those in the delete all, and I think it's in pretty good shape. We may have to do a little more tweaking, but I'd take any questions.
Okay, thank you. We've got Representative Davis and Eastland. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hansen. Basically two questions. The first question is, the 7-year business, I believe that the final Green Acres issue is at 3 years. Why would we go back 7? Shouldn't we match up with 3?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Dave. That's a good question. I didn't want to have that a violation of the law could be intentional so that you would, let's say you wanted to get out, so you break the law and you hop out, that the 3-year payback, the 7-year payback would be a greater incentive for not breaking the law or having that intentional action as a way to get out. So that was my reason for choosing 7.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, my other question is, have the farm bureaus of the world and the farmers unions, how do they react to a bill such as this?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative David, I've talked with Mr. Raddatz this morning. He cannot be here. I told him some of the changes I was doing, the delete all. They like those, or he said that they would like those types of changes to clarify and to further define what type of violations, you know, so we're not getting those warning letters that trip it in, that it's really a egregious violation. And so those type of things, they'd like that that more definitions. And I think we've started on that road. We have a couple other things that have come, I think what Mr. Raddatz said was they appreciate the opportunity to work with me and that I'm moving in the direction that they would like.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, have you heard from Tom Peterson from Farmers Union? Has he weighed in on this at all?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Davids, I believe we had some discussions back around the 17th of March, but none recently. So I have not had I know Mr. Raddatz because that was this morning right before I came. So
thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, I guess I got some questions, just a couple of them. First of all, on line 117, you use this description quite a lot. Final enforcement action means any administrative, civil, or criminal penalty or action. I mean, it seems to me, I'm not an attorney, but it seems to me there's quite a difference between the administrative and a civil and a criminal activity. And we're treating them all the same here. And I guess that's my first question is, can you spell out what defines those three categories and why they're all thrown together with basically the same penalty?
And Representative Hansen, after you answer, you may want to ask Mr. Michael too as well, who is an attorney, and he can walk through what those different things do. Representative Hansen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Eastland, that's a good question. And just, I don't know if you know my background, but I did work at the Agriculture Department. I used to send out the advisory letters. I used to send out notice of violation letters for pesticide violations. And there are a range of actions and orders that take place as administrative. It is very rare for, under the 18 statutes and even the water statutes, for those to be carried into criminal court. That's a rarity. Most of the actions are taken in administrative or civil. I have some numbers here that the Department of Agriculture has provided for calendar year 2008. And there were 821 total actions that were taken. But of those, 9 were advisory notices, 263 were notices of violation, and 86 were notices of intent. And those are where there was actual penalty applied. So about 10% of those, and again, this is statewide, were actual administrative civil violations where the respondent paid a penalty. You have statement of completion, field orders, cease and desist actions, those type of advisory actions that are in the administrative penalty toolbox. And I believe that the tool or the statute or the definition I have in here can help clarify that. I did have Department of Ag, just as I walked up, point on lines 1.17 that the words or action may bring some of those in, and it would be my intent not to include that. But this gives you an idea of the numbers. Very few criminal prosecutions. In addition, I've been speaking primarily on the agriculture area and the 18Bs and those pesticide fertilizer type of actions. In the wetlands area, you may have a corrective action order where, let's say that there was a discovery that there's a violation, and the enforcement, the administrative action is to, say, stop it and clean that up. And it would not be my intent that if someone complies with that administrative order, that would tip them into doing it because they're coming into compliance. What I'm looking at here is that intentional, you know, I'm going to go drain the wetland, or I'm going to dump the chemical, or I'm going to break the law, and not somebody who is coming into compliance that they do through the advisory letter warning. And I know that we have Department of Agriculture here if you did want to seek further testimony. But I hope this clarifies some of my intent here, and we may need a few more wordage changes as this goes on.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess that's kind of my question. I don't think that's clear. in the language here at all. I think it basically is pretty much wide open, and the you know, the penalty is pretty much across the board, regardless of what kind of an action is taken here. And I guess the another question that I had was, you refer to chapters 18b, 18c. Could you give us an example, or give me an example of a situation that maybe you have experienced in dealing with that maybe would have resulted in this kind of a sanction and would have actually required somebody to be out of, what kind of an example? I mean, the other life that I come from is a farmer. And I understand how easy it is to, when I read this law and say that, well, you can't put fertilizer on unless there's a test that says you're deficient in this. I mean, there's a lot of room for, things to happen that would actually be opposed to what we have in statute here, and they happen every day,
right,
on farms all across the state. And I understand that we're not out there trying to micromanage everything, but we need to have some general principles. And I guess that's my question: is we have people who are just out there living their life, trying to do their job on their farm, and something happens, and they would be all of a sudden subject to a huge penalty and probably lose their livelihood. And it could happen very easily. So could you give an example of maybe the kind of a thing that you would interpret as being falling under this criteria?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, and I don't believe I ever sent you any letters, so I'm hoping I didn't.
No, you didn't.
I'll use one example that we had in reviewing restricted use pesticide sales and purchases. And As a private applicator, you need to go into the dealership and you need to purchase. When you purchase a restricted use pesticide, you have to be a certified applicator. And so you sign in, you know, and you write your number down when you're going in. And that shows that you have the competency to apply the chemicals that are of a greater risk to the environment or to yourself. And we would go in and we would review those records, and we may have somebody who their birth date or their expiration was off by a month or two, and we would send them a warning letter or an advisory letter saying, you know, you might have missed out. But we would have other people that may have come in year after year after year after year and just refused to get certified. And they were applying the pesticides, they were buying quantity, they would refused to be certified, we would take an action with the dealer. But if we showed this history of continuous, I'm just not going to do it, and I'm going to keep buying, or maybe you won't sell to me anymore, I'll go over here and apply, then we would take that into account. And I'm using we here when I work at the Ag Department. We would take that into account to show that record and that past practice. So then that would tip into a notice of intent where there's a violation. You'd find in the finding of facts that history that was there. And if I may, Madam Chair,
yes, please.
We do have some precedent in this in terms of this cross-compliance. I often, not often, but I also had to, let's say someone didn't pay child support. We have a law that says that their license would be pulled. If someone had back taxes, we had a cross-compliance requirement where their license would be pulled. And so I would get a notification from the Revenue Department or from relating to lack of payment of child support. I would then do a revocation of license based on that. I would send a certified letter out to the person who hadn't been paying child support, and then they would, and then when they came back into compliance, then we would lift that revocation. So we have some of this there. I'd be willing to work with you, you know, to try to clarify this, because I want to be clear. It's not my intent to capture people with this consequence who may have inadvertently violated the law. I want some of this strong intent. If they're receiving the tax benefit and they go, we're going to do this anyway, I think all of us want to prevent that from occurring.
That's amusing.
And I appreciate that. And I guess going along that line, I guess I don't know where the Department of Ag is on your whole bill, and they evidently have some concerns about it as well. I guess what I would like to see, if we're going to go down this road, is that there would be maybe a an accelerated penalty? I mean, there would be, if you meet the criteria for noncompliance the first time, there would be a fine. And so there would become a kind of a pattern of abuse that would be developed over time, and there'd be some increasing penalties before we would go to this route, because this actually would put some people out of business if they were in the agriculture business. And I understand farmers have their own mind and they want to do things their own way, but they're persuadable without just kind of putting them out of business. So that would be my concern. I think this is just going a little too far, too fast.
And Representative Hansen, we have Representative Broad. We are going to take public testimony, too, so if anyone is here who wants to speak for or against this bill, you know, please come forward. But I do, I want to encourage you, Representative Hansen, to work with Representative Eastland and others before, if we do this in the omnibus tax bill, we certainly can change language on these items, because I have not heard in the debate that anyone had concern with cross compliance. I think the people who want to keep these programs want them to work. And so I know that that's something that, you know, if we can address Representative Eastland's concerns and others who might be, and it seems like you've already acknowledged that you're open to that, I think that would be helpful. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hansen, the couple things that concern me, one is the or action, and it sounds like you're going to be addressing that, so I appreciate that. But the second one is on lines 1.11 and then on lines 3.3, the words or tenant. I'm trying to figure out how an absentee owner could be held to the standard that you're trying to hold. And again, I agree with the cross compliance argument that we want folks to do the right thing and not be rewarded for not doing the right thing. But I'm trying to understand how that or tenant fits with a landlord. In terms of taking the landlord out of a program for something that the tenant did.
And Representative Barr, are we on the DE1 amendment of 1.11?
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
members.
Sir, yep.
Okay, so does everyone see that? 1.11. Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, and I would maybe ask Mr. Michael to look at that in terms of the, if we have that precedent there.
Okay, so Mr. Michael or Ms. Baker, whoever would like to take that to Representative Broad's question.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, I'm not familiar with, this is sort of more of an agriculture law enforcement pollution environmental thing that I am just not familiar with, whether or not we hold landowners responsible for actions of their tenants. Maybe somebody from the Ag Department or someplace else.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, I believe we have some. There is some responsibility there for the owner of the tenant action. But Representative Broad, I'd be willing to work with you and council to try to make sure that that's clear. And I don't know if Mr. Bezicki.
We don't see anybody acting like they want to come up here and
answer. It looks like they're talking.
Sort of guessing that maybe people in the audience don't know, but Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I can understand the draining of the wetland if an owner is kind of watching that occur. But
right.
In terms of the application of a pesticide, if you're an owner who is not necessarily knowledgeable of or a party to any application of a pesticide, it seems like this might be a harsh reality for those folks who wouldn't have any ability to tell you whether their tenant has done things right or wrong. I think about a noise statute or something like that in an apartment. If the tenants are loud and noisy, well, does the apartment owner then get things revoked? So I think that there are some significant issues related to the tenancy, and I would imagine some of it would depend upon the contract that the owner and the tenant have as well. And I think that might be a pretty significant challenge going forward. But, Madam Chair, I'm wondering, Representative Hansen, has this gone to Ag Committee? Because it might be appropriate that they do actually weigh in on these issues, because I think, as Mr. Michael stated, these are Ag-oriented things that they understand the contracts between tenants and landlords probably better than I would ever imagine to.
Okay, Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Broad, to your first question, there are some variability in terms of the statute. So if there's a storage requirement, then you know that's a little different than an application. If you are storing restricted use pesticides on site, or if you have over a certain quantity of fertilizers on site, then the owner has a little higher responsibility than the applicator just making the application on the property. In terms of has it gone to the committees, throughout this Green Acres debate, we have had discussions. It has not gone to the Ag Committee or the Environment Committee. However, Representative Kunin, Representative Marquardt, Representative Junkie, Representative Wagenius, and I have been working on this for since introduction.
Madam Chair, I'd like to have the motion revised to, we just sent another one to off to another committee. Heck, let's do another one. I really think the issues that are significant around this, I think from a tax committee standpoint, the cross compliance is not the issue. I think the issues are actually much more related to ag and environment issues, and I would really like those committees to not only have a small subgroup of folks working on it, but to have more public testimony on this, because I think it's a pretty big change. And Representative Hansen, I appreciate where you're trying to go. I just want to make sure we get there the right way.
And Representative Sombra, I just want to say the problem we have on that one, because the other one was Environment Finance, is the policy committees are closed up. They're past deadline. So we really can't send a policy bill off to a policy committee anymore this year. So, I mean, if someone has a thought here.
The Rules Committee, I think, has the ability to sweep something back there, and I think this would be an appropriate use of that for the Rules Committee to move this back into a policy committee, which can reopen up at any point if the committee chair chooses to do that. But Representative Hansen, I think this is a significant policy change, and I would really hope that this would get back to one or two of those committees, because I think it's absolutely appropriate that that happens. And Madam Chair, the Rules Committee does that quite often. And this is a time where it actually would have bipartisan support.
Okay, and we're going to take Representative Lanning and Demmer. We want to get to public testimony for this bill, but if folks don't mind, I'm just going to try to read the rule during while we take some more questions, because I thought it took a supermajority to reopen the policy committee. So, and I'm not clear on that, so I'll just kind of think on that a little bit. But we also have Representative Lanning and Representative Demmer and public testimony. So I think we have time to decide on the motion. What I'm saying. Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, and I mentioned at the beginning of this testimony that this is the second hearing where this committee has heard it, that it was presented March 17th. So,
oh, that's right.
You know, this is this probably is receding, and I think there's the opportunity for folks here to hear this. And I believe it was also discussed during the open conference committee with the opportunity for public input as well. So, I think that that's an important factor in this, that, you know, we want to make sure that the public dollar is being protected, and we do have the opportunity for testimony here.
Okay, and so we've got Representative Broad back to this point and Representative Demmer to this point. You are reminding me, though, Representative Hansen, and members should know that when we had the Joint Property Taxes Committee, we did hear this, and we had invited the Ag Chair and Representative Wagenius to the hearing. So we'll be able to get some information from them on how they want to pursue this. Representative Broad and then Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but this is a significant substantive amendment that absolutely changes the direction that you're trying to go. It brings in tenancy. It brings in the other actions. It brings in the 7 years. It brings in all sorts of policy judgments that are definitely within the realm of agriculture. So while I appreciate the tee-up of the issue earlier, the changes are dramatic and substantive and really is appropriate for a policy committee.
Okay, thank you. Representative Demmer to that point. And then Lanning. Well, you were giving us the signal to that point, or no? You two can work it out.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Madam Chair. It is to this point that I got to agree very, very strongly with Representative Broad on this one, Madam Chair. This is a significant change on a couple of fronts. Number one, I think Representative Eastland just made the point. You know, this is the purpose of this program is to keep land in agriculture. And basically, this is changing that significantly and by tossing it out. Number one. Number two, by increasing to 7 years instead of the 3 years is a significant change. Very, very appropriate to go in agriculture. And as we know, last year we had all kinds of difficulties when leadership did not refer the Green Acres Bill to agriculture. So definitely needs to be done. Second thing is the tenant thing that Representative Broad things brought up is very, very huge. That could go actually to a level of anybody that rents out a house, anybody that rents out an apartment building, having to police the people living in their building in case there's some sort of a problem. That's huge. The reality is when you rent something out to somebody in a farm situation, when you rent it, you don't go out and see what they're doing. You don't go out and see what they're putting on. You don't go out and monitor what days they're out there. That's unrealistic. That is a huge policy issue for agricultural producers. And quite frankly, beyond agriculture, it might even need to go to something like commerce, because if you're talking about a tenant-owner relationship, and having consequences to an owner for what the tenant's doing on that property, and usually these leases are drawn up in a way that the tenant has unimpeded use of the property, subject to criminal activity. This could go to the point of, like I said, somebody renting out a house or an apartment building that conducts some sort of illegal activity or does something wrong, going back to the owner of that. So huge implications, Representative Hansen. I really believe this merits going back to rules and going back to those committees for a fully vetted discussion.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen.
I want to be clear. We are not debating the pesticide penalties. We are debating the preferential tax treatment that people receive. That people are receiving a preferential tax benefit that is voluntary, that they apply for, and that they enter into an agreement for, to have their taxes reduced and other people's taxes raised for that beneficial tax treatment. We're not debating penalties for pesticide application, and we're not debating wetlands enforcement. We're saying when that enforcement occurs, that is a violation, and my intent is to make that a significant violation, that the assessors are notified so that the people that are receiving preferential tax treatment, where their taxes are reduced and other people's taxes are raised, that they do not continue to receive that benefit, and they pay back that benefit that they have received. I have limited with this amendment. I had an unlimited payback before. I have limited that to 7 years. So I believe this is within the scope of the tax committee, because we're talking about property tax reductions and increases after these enforcement actions take place.
Okay, so we want to get to public testimony. Representative Demmer, please.
Well, very quickly, this isn't a tax reduction. This is about valuations. This isn't about tax rates. It's about valuations, and that results in taxes. But the Ag Preserve Program, as well as Green Acres, is about valuations. It has nothing to do with tax rates.
Representative Hansen.
I believe it does have to deal with the taxes that individuals pay. So there are tax reductions that occur for people who enroll in these programs, comparable to what they would be paying if they were not enrolled in these programs.
Well, and the evaluations are, of course, this committee as well. I mean, that's the assessed value by the property tax assessors. So, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if staff could give us examples of cross-compliance with regard to any other property tax provisions. I'm trying to think of other examples, and none are coming to mind immediately, but...
And Representative Lanning, I was thinking about that, too. I could think of, we recapture, for example, if you qualify for the property tax refund, you don't get it. If you owe taxes, the state takes it. And I think it's the political contribution refund as well. So, I mean, the state goes in and takes if you're not in compliance with paying your taxes. But I asked Mr. Michael, the one he mentioned that I hadn't thought of too, was in the area of the liquor tax, and maybe Mr. Michael can talk about that one or any others he can think of. Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, there is a provision in the excise tax law that if you have a license to sell alcoholic beverages and you don't pay your sales tax or the other taxes, that then the Department of Revenue notifies the Department of Public Safety and has them pull their license. There's similar provisions for professional licenses for people that don't pay income tax, for example, that you lose your, in theory you could have your license pulled as a result of that. And the property tax refund, if you're delinquent, that is, you didn't pay your taxes in the previous year, you don't qualify for the current year property tax refund. Most of these provisions in the tax area have been put into the law as a way to improve compliance and to assist the Department of Revenue in collecting taxes that are due.
Madam Chair.
Yes, please, Representative Myring.
I was more specifically looking at property tax classification and cross compliance there, and none of those examples related to that. And that's what I'm wondering. Is there a precedent for cross compliance when it comes to property tax classification, where if you do something wrong under some other statute, you're going to lose your property tax classification benefit that you might have had for whatever else?
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, neither Karen or I can quickly think of an instance where you're not complying with a regulatory law or something else like that that causes an automatic change in your property tax status per se, but, you know, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
The Department of Revenue can jump up if they can think of something. Representative Lanning.
Well, Madam Chair, that's my point. I mean, if there is other examples where this is being done, fine, then the precedent is established. But if we're going down a new road here, then we ought to know that. We ought to know that this is a new policy change with regard to tax policy, that you could lose your classification benefit if you make a mistake in some other section of law. That's a significant change.
Well, I guess, you know, just think about it. I see Mr. Hines has joined us now, so maybe he has that. You know, I think that everybody wants to ensure that if you're going to have some taxpayers pay other taxpayers' taxes, you want to be sure they're really doing what they're supposed to be doing to get the preferential treatment. So I don't think anybody would have an issue with that. I'm just trying to think of, say, let's say there's the veterans, you know, which they get property tax preferences, and other people pay the veterans' property taxes, so we make them show us that they're a disabled veteran. So I guess the question would be, you know, what would happen with the Department of Revenue if, in fact, they found out that they're not telling the truth? There's really no veteran living there, or they're not, you know, and I don't have the answer to that, but I think Representative Hansen's bill to me gets at the idea that, you know, we want to make sure that people are getting the benefit are actually farming or doing metro ag preserves or whatever it is. And this did come up in the conference committee, and I think there was nobody who had a problem with making sure that people were following the rules. It was actually more of a pro Green Acres issue in that it would preserve the integrity of the program so that people were actually doing what they said they were doing, so it wouldn't in the future then be undercut if, you know, if people felt that, you know, people were saying they were doing different activities and then they weren't doing them. That would ultimately kind of spell the demise of these programs. So,
yeah,
Mr. Hines, you want to take a shot at Representative Lanning's inquiry?
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, I was just going to recall, and partly to help trigger Joel and Karen's memories perhaps, that I believe that we did put in law that Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center pilot program, or I can't remember if that got enacted or not, which is kind of that thing with regard to rental housing. And then there used to be a provision in general law relating to rental housing, and if they had to be kept up to code, and there could be a different class rate. But that's since been repealed, I know.
Was that Representative Filstrom's bill that we're just now talking about, the pilot program, where there was some accountability there? Ms. Baker, do you want to add to that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Joel and I were just talking, and I do think in 27202, where we've got two exemptions for some native prairie and wetlands, if you don't follow those, they won't be exempt anymore. So that puts them back on the tax rolls. That would be one. And the other thing is the sustainable forest. You have to follow the management plans, and if you don't follow the management plans, you get pulled out of the program and don't get the credit and don't get the benefits. So there are some other...
And, you know, I'm just thinking of one, too, and I don't know what the penalty is of this, but I used to be a city council member, and I actually live in a bluff protection zone, me personally, and we have all kinds of pesticide and phosphorus use rules in my city. So, for example, what most people can put on their yards to fertilize their yards, I can't do that because I'm on a 50-foot bluff that would just pour into the waterbed and then, of course, create problems there. So I have different, unique... laws I have to follow on private property. I mean, this is my property, but I have to follow these, and I honestly don't know what the penalty would be if I was out there dumping the fertilizer on in my backyard. So, this is a very good discussion, but I don't have the answer. Representative Liebling, then Broad, then Demmer. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to ask whether Job B would be an example of this.
Yeah, that's right. Mr. Michael. because there are property tax exemptions in the Job Z program.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, there are definitely sanctions for violating, for not living up to your Job Z agreement that requires repayment of 2 years of taxes that were, received as a result of the exemption.
Mr. Representative Liebling, further? No. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move this, amend the motion to move this to Ag Finance. That way we don't have to deal with the rules situation with policy.
Okay, so Representative Broad, I think you have to move to Finance.
Finance, pardon me. Finance.
Representative Broad amends the motion to send this bill to Finance. Okay, so Representative, we're not going to vote on that yet. We've got the motion before us, but we have still questions. Representative Demmer.
Well, Madam Chair, I think this is a good discussion, and I guess I was just going to make the point you mentioned about the veterans, and that is a good one. However, they get the qualification because they're a veteran, and they wouldn't lose their veteran status if they violated the law by murder, for example. You don't lose your tax qualification by doing some sort of other law-breaking activity. That's not the reason you got the status. You got the status because you're a veteran, not because you're following the law. And in this case, you're in the Ag Preserve, not because you're using the right pesticides, but because you're farming the land. So I would beg to differ a little bit with your analogy there. And even in terms of having requirements to stay in the program, that's true for this also, as is for Green Acres. There are certain things you are required to do. Now, we might say to be in Green Acres, this will give you an idea, Representative Hansen, to be in the Green Acres program, the Ag Preserve, in the new rural preserve, you have to have a management plan in place, which may include certain uses of pesticides and that sort of thing. And that would be then part of your contract, being in the preserve. That might be a situation that would say you could move it out. But just to say that because I'm a veteran, I'm getting special tax preference, if I break the law and get caught with substance abuse or something like that, that I'm no longer a veteran, I get veterans preserve, that would be more analogous to what we're trying to do here. And so, Madam Chair, that's a point I was going to make when you use your example. They don't get the preference because they're law-abiding. They get it because they're a veteran.
Okay, to that point, did you have more, Representative Demmer? No. Okay. To that point, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Hansen, you've really started up here this morning. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment about how you don't lose your preference, for example, for a veteran if you get caught with drugs. Well, you do lose your preference for getting financial aid to go to college. So we do have those kind of penalties in law all over the place. And so this is no different. When you fill out your FAFSA form, you have to click that you have not been convicted of a drug offense. And if you have, then it says, then you're not eligible under the program. So, Madam Chair, this is no different.
And to that point?
Yes, Representative Garofalo, then Representative Mullery. Representative Garofalo.
To that point, as the argument was made previous to the recess, that's a federal issue. That's not a state issue. The FAFSA form is a federal requirement. We only handle state policy here.
I think with a couple of college students, neither of them in Minnesota, though, I'm pretty sure that you get a lot of Minnesota students get Minnesota state aid as well, in addition to federal aid. Representative Murray.
Madam Chair, to that point, I checked into it. Federal does that on state aid to students. Minnesota doesn't do it.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I could...
Representative Hansen.
So, but I do want to answer that question about management plans, because what I'm not talking here, Representative Denmer, about management plans. I'm talking about violation of statute, existing statutes. Not talking about normal use, not talking about best management practices, not talking about how to reduce or change or integrate pest management. I'm talking about willful violations of statute. And I believe, and the reason I put the bill out here and the reason I'm continuing to amend it, is I believe if you're receiving beneficial tax treatment for a purpose of protecting ag land or having an environmental benefit, then you should comply with those environmental and agricultural laws. If you do not, then you should not have the benefit.
Okay. Is there there's no one else on the list right now. Public testimony. Anyone who would like to speak for or against this bill or would like to enlighten us about something or have a personal example you'd like to share?
Madam Chair.
Nobody? Okay, Representative Hansen.
If it would help the committee, well, you already have a motion on the floor, so I can't. Yes. I was going to just suggest an oral amendment on 117, but we can do that after you.
Okay. Further discussion. Okay, members, I'm going to recommend that we vote down Representative Broad's motion I think that we have an issue here that it's hard to get this off policy. We've been looking for Reps and Junkie while this discussion has been going on. And since we lay everything over for possible inclusion, we can take this back up. Another way that could this could be addressed is Representative Hansen can, as he works on this with Representative Easton and others, he can remove the pieces that are objectionable to people. But I do just want to say, in encouraging people to vote this down, I mean, compliance is the prerogative of the tax committee members. We have a whole section of the Department of Revenue dedicated to compliance. We have a significant tax gap in this state, and we have put money and hired, I think, in the last couple of years, 60 auditors in the Department of Revenue to make sure people are complying. And we lose a lot of tax money every year for people who aren't complying to various pieces throughout the Minnesota state law, and if we could collect all of that, we'd all be better off. So, you know, I admit I am one of the people who are a fan of compliance. I have opposed these tax holiday concepts as well because they encourage non-compliance, and I think anything we do, if we're serious about it, we should, compliance should be okay. I mean, I don't think people want the integrity of the, you know, I've never heard anyone who's advocated for these programs also say it's okay for people to not actually do what they're saying they're going to do to get the tax benefit. And this is a tax benefit program that is being subsidized by other taxpayers. So at this point, I would encourage a no vote on the Broad Amendment. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't think that our concerns ought to be construed as in favor of noncompliance. You know, the concerns that we're raising are not about the compliance piece of it. It's about the practicality of how you actually hold somebody accountable in certain ways and whether you are requiring them to pay back further than the program even requires if they get out of it. So the issues are more technical that we're having, and that's why we're trying to get a full airing of the concerns in this DE amendment that we're just seeing here today. And again, it's the concerns are related to the tenancy. How do you hold tenants, landlords accountable for their tenant putting a pesticide on wrong? What are those issues? Are issues related to what does or action even mean? Does that broaden it out too long? Issues related to the 7-year payback on a program that now requires only 3 years to get out. And so it's not a compliance issue that the concerns are being raised upon. I just want to make sure we put that on the record. The issues are related to the practicality and what this means to the ag community in our state. And the argument, Representative Hansen, I think you make a good argument related to this being a tax issue. I think most of it is a tax issue. But if we held the Green Acres argument the same way, there would be no reason for Green Acres to go to any other committee or would have to sit here in the tax committee yet. We all agreed that the policy around Green Acres was such that the Ag Committee and the Environment Committees should want to see them, would want to see those issues, and I think the same goes for this related to the concerns that we're having, which again, Madam Chair, are not related to the compliance piece. They're related to the technical practicality of how you actually accomplish what I think Representative Hansen's tried to accomplish. So the motion is just to get it off to Ag Finance so they can take a peek at it. It's not all that controversial. I understand why you might not want to do that, but I think it's worth voting on. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think that the concerns that Representative Broad has raised are ones that I've said that I'm willing to work on. I think the motion that was originally on the table was to lay this over for possible inclusion. That gives time to work on these issues before you bring up any omnibus tax.
And it's my intention, members, in encouraging a no vote, to ask Representative Junkie personally today when I can find him somewhere if he's interested in hearing this, and we can certainly send it out or he can hear it informationally too. I just think at this point, with policy committees closed up, it's best to just leave it here for now, and then we can do further work to address all the concerns. So, discussion to the Broad motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. No. The motion does not carry. We're back on the bill now to be laid over for possible inclusion. It's House File 1798 as amended. Further discussion? And I don't recall who made the initial motion. Representative Coonan. So Representative Coonan renews his motion, and this will be just to lay it over for I guess we don't need a motion. I'm just going to go ahead and lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. So thank you, Representative Hansen, for a really exciting discussion. And you have another bill.
Another bill.
So now Representative Hansen, Representative Coonan will move this one for you as well. And I don't have the number in front of me. 2113. Representative Coonan moves House Bill 2113 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And you know, before we start this on members, you know, it is a point of consternation of members or of praise that this committee pretty much is the last committee to close up. It hasn't historically ruled on germaneness, and people are sort of allowed to do a lot of things here. They often don't succeed, but I think, you know, we do become, as the committees pass the policy deadlines, then they're going to pass the finance deadlines, and this is the last committee sort of alive and kicking. So a lot of things get moved here in the end. So I think we're going to see this throughout this week, and we need to be thinking about all of that. But Representative Hansen, you want to tell us about 2113?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. House File 2113 is a bill. We have had testimony in other committees about the benefit of having buffers, and we've taken action over the past few years relating to buffers along drainage systems. This is relating to riparian buffers and looking at the other, adding another tool to the toolbox that we have where we provide cost share or we provide easements. This is a method of providing a tax benefit through a covenant for riparian buffers. I'm going to hand out, and I apologize to the committee, a fact sheet from the Board of Water and Soil Resources. It's a two-sided fact sheet of estimates relating to acreage in riparian buffers, or in riparian areas.
Okay. And so the pages will get that from you. And before we proceed, Representative Hansen, Representative Coonan is going to move your amendment for you to get it in the order you'd like. So Representative Coonan moves H2113A1, the author's amendment. So discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the A1 amendment was based on conversations with some of the interest groups was to narrow the application so that it would be more fitting the type of areas that are being handed out with the Board of Water and Soil Resources there, that we would not be including residential areas, we would not be including forested areas, but we would be dealing with kind of agriculture where there would be 2A property adjoining those buffers, and it gives the landowner a choice where they can apply for either a term or a ongoing covenant and subsequent tax valuation. So okay. This is to use using the tax policy to protect buffers along riparian areas.
Questions? Is there a public testimony for or against the bill? Well, you must have taken the wind out of everyone's sails on the last one.
and I'd be willing to work with folks, you know, as if they have questions or concerns.
And members, this was offered by the House Conferees and Conference Committee. We couldn't quite convince the Senate. But I do want to just tell the public, Representative Broad and Eastland and others, Representative Davids, are right to be asking, you know, where are people on these ideas, you know, the author can't control that they didn't come today. These bills were posted early last week, and we would hope that those who have an interest in this bill, whether it's Farmers Bureau, Farmers Union, would be here. So, you know, whether it's the Department of Ag or whatever. So members know that next week we are going to take up down this tax bill, and, of course, all of that we will take public testimony on. So we sure hope that anyone who has a dog in any of the fights is going to be here to weigh in, because committee members will be interested to get answers to these sorts of questions, and I think they're important questions. So, further discussion. If not, we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Thank you.
Keeping us on our toes this morning. Is there any, now we're down to just members of the committee. Is there somebody who has a testifier here who needs to make sure that they get heard? Representative Dabney, yes, please. I apologize. And you were trying to get done by 10. So please, we're going to now hear Representative Dabney move House File 1625. If anybody else has someone that they need who's with them who needs to get their bill done, please just send a note. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the courtesy to my testifier. Members, it's the Sesame Street song. One of these things is not like the other. Currently,
In Minnesota, we know that we can always raise the taxes on rental cars because most of those taxes are paid by people who don't vote for us. And so we do tax them significantly. There's the 6.5% general tax. There's the short-term Minnesota lease tax is 6.2%. And then if the company has more than 20 cars, there's an additional 5%. So the average tourist or business person coming into the state pays for that 2 days or the week that they're leasing their car a 17.7% tax rate. What we have developing, however, here and across the country is an alternative to car ownership called car sharing. For people who, whether it's a single individual who chooses to go carless or a family that's trying to get by using just having just one car but finds from time to time they need a second vehicle for a family event, for going and making a large purchase for which they need a vehicle to transport that purchase, whatever it may be. It's a membership situation that is different than when I go to Denver to visit my sister-in-law and we rent a car to get around the Denver area. With me today is Mr. Chris Dufflin from Our Car, which is a nonprofit car-sharing enterprise in the Twin Cities area and is also familiar with the national picture. So, Madam Chair, can I move the House File 1625 be before the committee? And for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Representative, the avenue moves House Bill 1625 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Dufferin. Dufferin, is that right?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Chris Dufferin. I'm the director of the Neighborhood Energy Connection. We're a nonprofit organization based in St. Paul that works on energy efficient solutions for individuals and communities. And we run the car sharing program called Our Car and have done so for the past 4 years. Just quick background on car sharing. It's been around in the U.S. Since the mid-1990s. There are now several dozen car sharing organizations across the country. Most of them are nonprofit organizations. Our Car now has 750 members. We have cars in 17 different locations. And the way it works is members sign up and receive a little key fob. It's an electronic tool that they can use for entry and in and out of the cars. And then they pay for reservations, which they make online or by calling into a call center. They pick up our cars from one of our locations and then return it to the same spot. So these are all round trips they're making. And membership and usage fees cover all their expenses, including gasoline, insurance, maintenance. And this allows our members to save a lot of money on all the fixed costs associated with car ownership. Car sharing is really not, as Representative Devin said, it's not a rental car service at all. We don't compete with rental car service. We provide a choice for people other than car ownership. We're very different from rental car companies in several ways. We're membership-based. People are signing into a long-term contract. They're using these cars on hourly rates. Our cars are all unstaffed and they're accessible 24 hours a day. When we survey our members, we find that the majority of them bike, walk, or take transit every day of the week. So they're just using the car for occasional use, and that's why they've joined. And they tend to trip chain, too. They use our cars and do several different errands at once. And this, what this leads to is that they drive less. And the purpose of car sharing, ironically, even though we're providing cars, is to help people drive less. And so they're helping the state meet its carbon reduction goals that you put into statute 2 years ago. These are all, as Representative Dabney said, these are all local people, people living here in the Twin Cities area. And the majority of these people, our members, make less than $50,000 a year, so they tend to be a low to moderate income group. So despite being very different than a rental car company, we are taxed like a rental car company. We currently pay 13.45% when you combine all our taxes together, and that's 80% higher than a car owner. That's all state, local, and then the 6.2% rental car tax that we pay. And this bill won't change that. We'll continue, our members will continue to pay that 6.2%. Even though that's just $20,000 a year, for the state, that's a significant amount of money for an organization like us that doesn't have that many members. What this bill would do is exempt us from that 5% fee, and the way the 5% fee works is we would have to collect it if we had more than 20 cars. We don't have more than 20 cars at the moment. But if we did, we would have to collect that 5% and then pay the state the difference between the tab fees that we pay right now and that 5%. We tend to have lower tab fees because we don't hold on to our, we do hold on to our cars longer than a rental car company. A rental car company may turn over a car every year, and so that 5% fee tends to cover a larger portion of those tab fees than it would for us. It also, for the rental car companies, it maintains a level playing field. If they're charging 5%, they know their competitor has to charge the same 5%, and they're competing on the same playing field and not putting that into their rates. For us, it actually unevens the playing field because we're competing against car ownership, so it's a very different animal. So this bill wouldn't have an immediate budget impact because we don't currently pay the 5%. There may be a point in the future when we grow big enough that we would. So I hope that answers your questions about car sharing, and we urge you to support this bill, and thank you for considering it.
Thank you. Further public testimony on this bill? Anyone from the public for or against? Further questions from committee members? If not, Representative Dabney, we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Dietrich. And then Representative Garofalo, are you ready too? Okay, Representative Dietrich, then we'll go to Representative Garofalo. So, and so Representative Dietrich moves House File 1566 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Welcome.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1566 deals with a modification of mortgage registry taxes. And I just want to note that before I get started, that this bill was brought to me by the Minnesota Association of County Officers, which includes county auditors, treasurers, and recorders. A little bit of history on this, Madam Chair and members, is current law requires that if a mortgage is registered in the amount of over $1 million, and it is located in more than one county, the counties must share the administrative revenue collected, and they share that in proportion to the amount of land in each of the counties. Currently, counties receive 3% of the revenue of the tax to cover their administrative costs. The state receives the other 97% of that tax. But I want to point out that that was not always the case. Counties used to be able to keep all of the mortgage registry tax, with 3% being dedicated to the administrative costs and 97% of that going to the human services costs. But as I mentioned before, now the state takes 97% of that tax. Dividing up the 3% of that administrative cost is more of an administrative burden than it is worth, at least seen by some of us. When the county kept all of the revenue, it made a lot more sense to share the revenue among the counties. But now that it is such a small account and amount, and it is only to cover they only keep the amount that covers the 3% administration cost, it makes sense that to allow the county doing all of the administrative work to keep all of the administrative revenue. And I have Larry Dalian here, Director of Property Records in Anoka County, and he can just tell you a little bit about why he thinks that this also makes sense.
Welcome, Mr. Dalian.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I think the best way I can describe this is, first of all, on a $1 million mortgage, the 3% is $69. So it's really not very much money on a $1 million mortgage. However, if it's a $10 million mortgage, it's $690. So some could argue that it does get to be a considerable amount of money. But I have an example that my staff gave me that may shed a little light as to why we think this needs some change. There was recently a $13 million mortgage that was recorded first in Anoka County that also had land in 11 other counties, so there are 12 counties involved. The 3% administrative fee was $897 on that mortgage. After my staff contacted the other 11 counties, got all the market values of the properties in the other 11 counties, and went through the distribution process, because we have to use the market values from all the counties to prorate the tax, the 3% administrative fee amongst all the counties, the shares amounted to as low as $3 that we had to send a county. And the administrative cost of taking care of all of that process was more money than we actually ended up getting to keep, because all we got to keep was $100 in that process. So I think that it's time that this law was changed so that there is no need to share that administrative fee, because it's really meant to take care of administering, collecting the tax for the state of Minnesota, and it should remain in the county that does the collection.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Further public testimony for or against this bill? Questions for Mr. Daly and our Representative Dietrich? Assembly Link.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony. I mean, it certainly sounds like something that needs fixing, but the question that I have is about the fee being kept by the county in which the mortgage is first registered. And is there any advantage to somebody to... Would this give them the ability to county shop in terms of where they want to pay it? And would that be of any advantage to somebody to county shop?
I don't think so. I think there is a little bit of a difference in the tax in Ramsey and Hennepin County, but I'm not sure how that's dealt with in this process, if they actually collect additional tax, because they do have that brownfield 0.0001 that they get in Hennepin and Ramsey counties, but I'm not sure how that's dealt with.
Representative Leland, can I ask Ms. Baker to shed some light on this as well? Ms. Baker? We're kind of discussing the $5 issue. Ms. Baker.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we were just talking, and I think the only shopping that they might do would be there's an additional $5 fee if you're in the metro counties. So that $5 would be, you know, a minor kind of thing. We were just saying that maybe they'd have to pay it anyway, even though they didn't register it in that county because they have property in that county. So they may not even get away from that. But I think that would be the only real advantage.
Assembly Link.
Okay, well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that, Ms. Baker. I guess, you know, I mean, the bill sounds perfectly fine. I just want to make sure that we're not creating some unintended consequence by having that be the criteria for how, you know, which county gets the money. But it sounds like if we did anything else, we'd probably just be creating more layers of administrative bureaucracy and probably wouldn't be worth it. So.
Thank you. Yes, Ms.
Madam
Kelly.
Chair, speaking to the $5, if a mortgage is subject to the tax but you don't collect it in your county, you still collect the $5. So that really wouldn't matter.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Representative Dietrich, anything else?
No, I would just like to say that this bill has been heard in the Senate, and they also thought it was kind of a common sense type issue.
Thank you so much.
Uh-oh.
We're going to lay this bill over. We're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax. So thank you, Representative Dietrich, and we're going to go to Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, do you mind if I move it from here? Is that okay?
Sure, that's fine.
I'll move House File 2240 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Unlike Representative Dietrich's bill, the Senate hates my bill. So, no, they don't. I'm just kidding. Madam Chair, this would just extend the deadline for the Metropolitan Egg Preserve Program, currently in statute. It's set up March 1st. We push it back to June 1st. And then for this year, we would have it be August 1st, so there's some notification for citizens. With distribution of property tax statements, this would align, this schedule would align better with the distribution of those. I talked with staff, and they're not aware of any conflict or issues on it.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone from the public who would like to testify for or against House File 2240? Questions from committee members on House File 2240? If not, I think Representative Garofalo had the magic touch by staying in his seat. We're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. I think that's it. Unless somebody had something. Okay, thank you, Representative Garofalo. Appreciate that one. Let's see. We're going to try to get done so we don't have to come back tonight if everyone can keep going. So we've got Representative Murphy at House File 1288.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair and members, I will try and follow Representative Garofalo. I'm bringing this piece of legislation forward on behalf of constituents and small business owners in the district I represent. They used to get by mail notice from the Department of Revenue about changes in law dealing with sales tax, and they would read that at night so they knew what the law changes were and so they could comply. And because we're not sending those notices out as we used to, and instead information is posted but not necessarily noticed, they're not getting the information they necessarily need, and they're concerned about that. And so they asked if I could work to make sure that there was an electronic means of distributing that information on a regular basis. And so this piece of legislation asks to create a Department of Revenue listserv that people can sign up for so they can get notices of law changes so they can comply with sales tax changes so they can pay their taxes, which is what they want to do. And that's simply the legislation. I think it'll help small business owners in my district and other districts, and I'd ask for your support.
Okay, so is there anyone from the public who would like to testify for against House Bill 1288? Did the department have a comment? I would assume. Ms. Moser, please, welcome. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Linda Moser with the Department of Revenue. This project is already underway at the department. We have several listservs already set up so people can subscribe to get updates. Our current lists are for withholding taxpayers and our tax preparer community. But we are in the process of setting up lists for other tax types, including sales tax. And the sales tax one actually should be ready to go within the next couple weeks.
Great. So it's going to be the Murphy sales tax listserv then.
Yes, we'll list it that way.
Further questions from the committee for the department or for the author? Okay, if not, we're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax. So thank you, Representative Murphy. And
thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Moser. Let's see. We've got Mullery Dill, and Bukovina's not here. Are you ready, Representative Dill? Representative Dill. So Representative Dill now moves House File 1161 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
And thank you, Chair Lanchesky and members. This bill, let me tell you how it came about. Up in some areas in the state, if you can imagine, land is pretty reasonable yet, especially when it's really out there without very little access and things of that nature. And I'm going to use Lake County as an example. They're the ones that came to me with this. And people actually buy land very cheap, and then they start essentially a junkyard. And they start going out and they start getting from people things that they rummage through and salvage, old cars, and they take out the PC boards and they go pick up copper and they actually get old houses and demo them and haul them to the site and then tear down the walls and take the copper out of the walls and they demo it and then they leave everything there. And it looks like a junkyard, except it's just every imaginable thing. A junkyard, usually we think of cars or trucks or something like that. And I could avoid you with pictures. At some point I might share those with the chair, but there's multiple locations in Lake County as an example where this is happening. So the county goes to the landowner and says, you know, you're in violation of our blight ordinance and every imaginable ordinance when it gets like this. You don't have any license to operate this thing, and we want you to clean it up, and they don't do it. So it just continues to compound, and a lot of times, Madam Chair, they're doing oil and things that, you know, there's environmental consequences where they have barrels that they have oil in, they sell the used oil to someone who's heating a shop or something with it, and then the barrels lay there and then some leakage occurs, it may or may not. So the point of this bill is that the counties don't have any ability to levy or abate for those costs and then put it on the tax statement. And that's what this bill essentially does. Cities have about, under 429.021, they have about 20 different items covering everything including nuisances, which would be number 8 in that list of 20 items. And this would add these items to the list: environmental, wetland mitigation, because you can imagine people backing up and dumping old cars in wetlands and things of that nature to try and get rid of them, throwing garbage in wetlands, things of that nature, and that adds into the land use violations. So cities already have the authority, and some counties have the authority for nuisances. but they don't have it for either cities or counties, have it for environmental purposes, for wetland purposes, or land use violations. And what this would do is add those uses or remedial actions into the list. And just for the committee's edification, when there is an assessment made, the city presently and certain counties could put that on the tax rolls for up to 30 years, and under 429061 it delineates all of the conditions of which interest may bear on that and how often it's collected, how often it's given on a tax statement, and all the things. No different than if you have a road or street improvement or a street light improvement or a curb and gutter improvement or water and sewer improvements when they put in a special assessment on a tax bill. So that's how this all folds together, and it just expands the uses to include environment, wetland, and land use violations.
Okay, thank you. Is there any public testimony for or against this bill? Representative Holt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dill, are townships currently included in the definition of municipality? And is there a reason, if they're not, is there a reason we wouldn't include townships in the ability to do this?
Yeah, thank you. And there is in 421, I have to get the right paper turned over, in 429.021 subdivision 3, I think it is, I think it talks about towns as well. So it's listed in three different ways, cities, counties, and towns. And it's 11, I'm sorry, 11. It's 429.011, and it talks about subdivision 2 is municipalities, subdivision 2A are certain counties, and subdivision 2B are municipality and certain towns.
Have some calls.
Madam Chair, I just think that if we're going to expand this this authority, we should at least consider whether it should be expanded equally, and maybe it already is, whether it should be expanded equally to all local units of government. And Madam Chair, I guess, I don't know if Mr. Michael wants to comment on that. I have one more question for Representative Dill.
In Representative Coles, I was just asking Mr. Michael, maybe if Representative Dill is okay with that, maybe he could try to draft something now, and we could just add it now, because I think if you're okay with that, I think Representative Coles is making a good point, and we could get it clear for everyone, and then it would be in the order, unless you'd like to take it up later. Representative Dill?
Well, Madam Chair, before I left, I certainly understand and agree with Representative Coles. The towns didn't come to me, the counties did.
Okay.
But I don't want to leap into that until I have looked through all of this provisions and talked to staff about it, and I'm certainly willing, if they're not, to include them, but I'd like to do it when we do the bill markup.
Okay, so Madam Chair,
Chair, but then the bill will be included in the bill, so I'll go ahead and make the amendment.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I actually would agree with Representative Dill. I think that makes sense to, if we're going to include this in the bill, that we deal with this issue when it comes time to mark up the bill, so that the towns have an opportunity to weigh in, and the counties, and maybe there's a reason not to do it, I'm not sure, but Madam Chair, if I could, Representative Dill, one additional question, the new language on page 3, line 22, I'm a little concerned about how that language may be interpreted by local units of government. I don't know what a environmental violation is, or a wetland violation is, or a land use violation. I think a land use violation is probably the easiest of those, because presumably there's some kind of prescribed or permitted use, and somebody's not using the land in that way. But what's an environmental violation? It's clear that there's an environmental violation if pollution control finds there to be a violation or whatnot, but if the city or the county says there's an environmental violation, is that enough? I think that language needs some work, Representative Dill, to get tightened up. I don't have a problem with the example that you provided. I think that what you're proposing to do here makes a lot of sense, but I think we need to be very careful about the language and the breadth of that language and how it could be interpreted.
Okay, Representative Dill, and then Representative Liebling has questions as well. Representative Dill.
Well, it's a very good point, and I do think that, you know, counties and towns and cities do have land use ordinances, so that's the easiest one to define. And environmental and wetland, maybe we need to reference when we come in with the idea on the towns, the WACA laws or some environmental law that the state has that, you know, is the threshold for violation. That's what you're essentially saying. And
okay.
I'll take that under advisement, and when we mark up the bill, we'll have something to clarify.
Thank you. Yeah. Some calls,
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, I appreciate that. Again, the example you described makes a lot of sense, but if we're going to allow this new authority, we should probably make sure the standards that can trigger this new authority are clearly defined. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a sort of a similar concern to Representative Coles, and that is that just looking at this, what's in the bill here, and just the sections of existing law that were given with the bill, I'm not really sure what the what kind of due process rights a person gets in these situations, and I assume there are some, but in the sections we're adding here, I just would wonder, you know, how much kind of, what a person would do if suddenly the county's saying, you know, you've got this wetland violation. And that's kind of related, I think, to what Representative Coles is saying, you know, what other sections are brought in with this language. And then I'm just going back to the previous discussion for a second. I'm glad we're going to hold off and not amend this right now, because on line 1.8, where it says in current law, municipality also includes, so I'm thinking this whole section, it's kind of like this is part of something else that I don't really feel comfortable here. What exactly would we be doing if we're adding more entities to it? So I'm glad that's going to get some more thought, but maybe Representative Dill could tell me if there are some due process protections that go along with this.
Representative Dill.
And thank you very much, Geraldine Chesky and Representative Liebling. In 429.036, you would find appeal from determination of legality of petition, where it discusses in the first paragraph, or first sentence, any person being aggrieved by the determination may appeal to district court in the county which the property, and it goes on to talk about the procedure that would be basically an appeal of the assessment that is under that would be authorized under 429.
Okay, and then Representative Dill, thanks for that. And so from understanding you, that same protection would apply to this new language that you're adding here?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
All right, okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? Further public testimony? Now we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion on this text. So we've got Mullery and Rukavina, and then we won't have to meet tonight. So whichever is ready to go. So please, Representative Mullery, I don't know that Representative Rukavina was here early at 9 o'clock. Then he disappeared.
I bet you I can do my bill quicker than Representative.
Okay, well, you two, whatever you like. Whatever you two work out.
I'll do it here while he's moving.
Okay, so Representative Rukavina moves House File 2079 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and that's the bill, and I'd appreciate your support. Madam Chair, what the bill does is the opportunity. Progressive income tax surcharge, and I do have an amendment, A1 amendment.
Okay, Representative Rukavina moves the A1 amendment. Discussion? All those in favor say, well, it's just to get it in the order.
And what the amendment does is adds increasing or decreasing for the word increasing, and basically it's the rate of inflation goes down instead of up.
Okay. We'll wait till everyone has it. But we'll get it in the order you want. So, members, the amendment is the H2079A1. Does everyone have it now? Not quite. People are getting worried now with these kind of bills that we've not even voted, being on record on an amendment. Representative Rukavina. Okay, we're almost there. And we should continue to recognize Megan and James do so very much for us, and we have a very busy week ahead, and they're going to be working very hard. So we've got it. This is to get it in the order that Representative Rukavina would like it. He's described his discussion to the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Rukavina.
Well, Madam Chair and members, the bill is basically a progressive surtax on income, and what it does is it raises about, the new note that I had a little different note initially, but about $1.3 million in this biennium, and about $1.55 million in the next And what it does is, based on adjusted gross income, it has a 6% surcharge on incomes of under $30,000, and then between 30 and 80, it's 8%, 80 to 250, it's 10, and over 250, adjusted gross income is 12%. And members, you know, I believe in fair taxes, Representative Garofalo, and I think this is a fair approach to our financial crisis that we're in. The last time that we were in a really tough financial crisis, then Republican Governor Cui, in the end, agreed to a income tax surcharge and actually a sales tax increase and to solve the budget crisis and get us out of the legislative session. And I'm hoping that Governor Pawlenty realizes the wisdom of a former Republican governor and having to compromise and do what's fair and what's necessary. And, you know, the governor has admitted that he needs revenue, he raises it a different way, and I think this is a fair approach to it, Madam Chair. So that's the bill.
Okay, discussion to the bill. Is there any public testimony for or against this bill? Silence. Okay, discussion to the bill. Well, I think you're right, Representative Rukavina, that you were able to do this fast. If there is no, if there, Representative Coles.
Well, Madam Chair, we can't let this move without a little bit of discussion. Representative Rukavina, thank you for being the honest liberal that you are. Thank you for that. Representative Rukavina, I appreciate the fact that you're coming forward with a proposal. I couldn't disagree with it more, but I appreciate the fact that you're coming forward with a proposal. Representative Rukavina, I guess, you know, really more a comment than a question. I'm really concerned about this approach and the fact that, you know, it really, you claim it's a fair approach, but I would suggest that it's a punitive approach that is going to chase productivity out of the state of Minnesota. And I think in these economic times, when we're facing some of the highest unemployment that we've seen in modern history here in the state of Minnesota, this is really a punitive approach that isn't fair. And it isn't the type of, it's certainly not Minnesota nice, Representative Rukavina. And while I appreciate your effort to collect, to try to collect revenue, I don't think this is the right approach. I would note, Representative Rukavina, that unlike the Cui surcharge, or surtax, if my memory is correct, I believe that blinked on and blinked off, and this...
this blinks on and off, though,
I was reading the effective date, and I didn't see it. I see it now up in the text. Thank you, Representative Rukavina. I'm happy to be proven wrong on that. But Representative Rukavina, even still, you know, according to the revenue estimate, and these are average numbers, you know, the average tax increase for the nearly 2 million taxpayers that would be impacted by this is $335. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money for the people you represent up on the Iron Range. That's a lot of money for the people I represent in Western Carver County. And that's an average figure. There's going to be a whole lot of small business owners and farmers and other job creators who are going to get hit a whole lot harder than that $335. In fact, I just came from a meeting. I had to sneak out earlier, and I met with a small business owner. We were talking about electricity issues. And he was concerned about his electrical rates. He talked about, he actually runs a small printing company. And he talked about the fact that he's had to let go of some of his employees in good-paying jobs because his clients, his customers, are letting go of people. And he's seeing his business go down. And if you add this this additional cost and burden onto him as a small business owner, you know, he's going to end up laying more people off. And I don't think we want that in this economy. And I know you don't want that, Representative Rukavina, so I just think your approach is flawed. While I applaud your willingness to come forward with a proposal, most of the people on your side of the aisle haven't been as forthright about where they want to raise the revenue from as you have. I think that we're heading down the wrong path. So, Representative Rukavina, I look forward to voting no on this provision somewhere down the line, and I guess we'll see how this shakes out at the end of the day.
Well, Madam Chair, if I could, first of all, Representative Close, thank you for your compliment about my honesty. I assume you were comparing me to the governor's approach on that one.
No, just yourself.
Oh, okay. Secondly, I think it's Iron Range nice, this bill, and Minnesota nice. And thirdly, you know, I always tell you, Representative Coles, about averages. And it's like I use the example, the average size of an Iron Range, a member of the Iron Range delegation is 6'2" and 300 pounds. It's gone down a little, you know, recently, maybe it's 290 pounds. But in any event, then I walk in the room and that shoots averages.
100.
You know, I have a sheet here that some numbers that Ms. Mancy threw up for me, members, and I was going to try to get it to you, but it's been in my file on spot, so it was kind of blanked out here where the folds were. But let me just tell you, a married filing joint couple, Representative Coles, on the making $25,000 will pay zero. A single person will pay $51. A head of household, $31. I can guarantee you that under the governor's budget proposal, every one of those numbers will be twice as much on some type of fee that's going to come out of the governor's office at the end of this, or on property tax increases. For a $60,000 married couple, $139, I can guarantee you that's going to be less than what their property taxes are going to increase. For a $500,000 income, adjusted gross income, now this is the argument I've had with Representative Garofalo on adjusted gross incomes, the dollar amount will go up. It will be for $100,431 on a married couple, and for $500,000, $4,222. And members, I just want you to think about something. There are all kinds of fees and local taxes and local assessments that have gone up to plug the holes because of the cuts, whether it's the local government aid or other programs we used to pay for out of general fund dollars. So, Representative Coles, I hope you think about that when you talk about an average increase of 350 or whatever you mentioned. And finally, you know, members, during recessions, even as bad as this, there are a lot of people that make money. And those people can afford to pay. If you're not making money under this proposal, you're really not going to pay anything. And so, members, I would appreciate your support again on the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Garofalo, less than down. Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, just help me. What time do you want to be out of here today?
Well, we'd like to get to Representative Mullery's bill, which I guess Representative Rufovic was taking a little longer, and be done by 11:30 so everyone can get to the floor. So, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief then. Representative Rukavina, like Representative Coles, I actually do want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. The reason being that I think something, when this session is over, and at some point it's going to be over, we're going to look back, and one of the things that we are going to regret is that we did not prepare the public for what we're going to be doing to them. And I'm saying we are going to do to them. I think we have totally sugarcoated it to the public of what is coming, and they are completely unaware of what's going to happen. And so anything that puts proposals like this, while I'm against it, on the table, so we're at least having this conversation and talking about it, that's a good thing. The one thing I want to talk with you about is you used the buzzword in your testimony. You said fairness. And I want you to explain to me and the members of this committee why raising taxes on the segment of society that already pays the highest percentage of their income in taxes, that would be the top 1, 5, 10, and 20%, why raising the percentage of the income they pay in taxes is fair when they're already paying the highest percentage.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, Madam Speaker, just going by the tax incident study, and you're right, they're paying the highest percentage on income taxes. But when you make $25,000 a year, Representative Garofalo, and you've got to put a new set of tires on your car because you drive like a lot of our constituents from rural Minnesota do, you know, 40 miles one way to have a job. The sales tax on those tires are a lot more regressive than for a person in that income bracket you were talking about, and Representative Coles thinks I'm not being Minnesota nice on. And so when you take into account all the other taxes, you know,
what the tax incident study says. And you and I can disagree on the federal end of it, and I still disagree with you because, you know, Mr. Buffett said publicly that he pays less in taxes than his secretary, and I kind of don't think that that multi-billionaire would make that statement, but, you know, that's a whole other issue. But when it comes to Minnesota, we know what the tax incident study says, and this will help fix it up a little bit. And it's just a temporary thing to get us through emergency, an emergency situation that we're in. And I appreciate your comment, Representative Garofalo, that we, the public, really, I don't think, still understands the financial mess that the whole country is in. And I thought this was a fair way to do it. Am I willing to compromise on numbers? Help me. You know, help me. Be fair to you. I don't want to nick your pocketbook any more than Representative Carlson's or Blesch's. So,
Representative Garofalo.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Rick, I'll just make this point again. I understand the argument that says this person has more money so they can afford to pay. I don't agree with it. I understand that argument. What I don't understand, in seriousness, is how someone can say it is more fair to disproportionately raise taxes on the people who are already having the highest percentage of their income in taxes. You keep going back to the tax incident study that is for a different purpose. If you're talking fairness, you can't reference the tax incident study because it's not a complete picture of who pays taxes. Again, I only bring this discussion up with fairness. Help me understand how it is fair that when person A pays a higher percentage of their income taxes than person B, that shifting more of the burden on the tax than person A is fair.
Representative Chair, and I apologize for taking the time. Representative Garofalo, starting with President Reagan, who cut income taxes, and finishing with President Bush, the previous one, who cut income taxes, they've made the whole system less fair, I believe. And I am trying to get it back to the way that it was. I don't think wealth has ever been concentrated in the hands of the wealthiest people in this country like it has been in the last few years since the turn of the last century. And so, you know, this country, it's a beautiful country. It was always based on fairness and equality, and I'm trying to get back to that. And I see, I guess, fairness in a different way than you, and I can't help you. I wish, you know, Representative Garofalo, you're a pretty young kid, and you're going to get more conservative as you get older, and that scares me. You started off really conservative, so I'm just hoping you maybe open up, you know, that what I know is an extremely intelligent mind, and take a look at this.
Just two very final points. Representative Rugavina, at the thought of stabbing myself in the back here, if you watch my politics very closely, I'm not really I am militantly reasonable. That's what I am.
Madam Chair, and I agree with you, so okay. This could help you get a little more reasonable.
And just as a matter of, because you brought up the federal tax, Representative Rugavina, the reality is, through the 80s of Reagan, through the 90s of Clinton, and with Bush, the tax code at the federal level became more progressive. They expanded the earned income tax credit. They increased the number of people who have no federal tax liability. That includes payroll taxes. So we have been slowly taking the tax base and shifting it to a smaller and smaller segment of society. Now, it is, in truth, in accuracy, it is because there's been greater income gains at the top of the spectrum. So that accounts for part of it, Representative Rukavina. But the tax decisions we are making, by shifting a greater and greater burden of the tax code to a smaller and smaller segment of society, are unsustainable. And they're bad for democracy because they insulate a majority of the public from the cost of government. And if you're not paying the bill, who cares what government costs?
And less Dowling Zeller's bill than less.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, I was looking at Representative Rukavina's bill and thinking about maybe you know, supporting it. Then I heard Representative Cole's statements. This is just not Minnesota nice, and I'm very concerned about that. Making sure that we continue our reputation as Minnesota nice. I know I have a pretty good reputation around here as being a nice guy, very diplomatic guy, very reasonable guy. And don't look at me like that, Representative Mulder. And I thought, you know, I'm not sure. And I thought, you know, I wonder if everyone in Minnesota has been the same nice. So I'm thinking, for example, high-income earners. And I wonder if if Representative Coles can answer a question on this. Based on the tax cuts, the reduction of the commercial industrial tax rate, and the income tax cuts about 9 years ago, have the Minnesota companies or high income earners been nice back? For example, in the creation of jobs, let's just take in the manufacturing sector, Representative Coles, have those high income earners been nice back and made jobs in the manufacturing sector based on those tax cuts?
Representative Coles, do you want to answer?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to, other than I would say that until recently we've had a pretty robust economy, generally speaking, here in Minnesota, and we've certainly seen a downturn in the last couple of years, and that's absolutely a concern to me. But you know, the job creators that you want to attack and go after have a lot of options, and they can move their jobs from Minnesota to South Dakota or to India. Or to Texas or Mexico, and I think we need to be very, very careful about the message we as a legislature are sending to our job providers here in Minnesota. But the short answer to your question is yes, thousands and thousands and thousands of Minnesotans are employed in good-paying jobs because of good, nice Minnesotans who want to see them have good-paying jobs here in the state of Minnesota. And if we continue to make our tax and regulatory environment here in Minnesota more difficult, more challenging for them, they're going to make decisions that is going to result in fewer Minnesotans being employed. So, Representative Lesh, I don't have numbers in front of me or statistics in front of me to say that X number of Minnesotans have a job today who wouldn't have had a job previously, or which sectors of our economy have struggled a little bit more than others and which sectors have grown. But Representative Lesh, the last thing we want to do is chase the people out of the state of Minnesota who are providing good-paying private sector jobs.
If I can, that's part of my problem with some Representative Coles. Based on this if-then argument, the suggestion is that somehow by reducing rates for these folks that we create jobs. Now, at best, based on the last 10 years, your argument falls flat because it's just not linked at all, apparently, because based on these tax cuts, we were supposed to create a lot more jobs. We've been bleeding manufacturing jobs, for example. But second, at worst, it suggests that based on those tax cuts, they are, as you stated, they're moving their jobs to India and Mexico and China and everywhere else. So it seems that Representative Rukavina's bill would have, if nothing else, just recognized the reality that wealth is even more unevenly distributed as it had been in the last 50 years. The members, the best economic boom in the last 100 years was during a period of this nation's history when we had the most progressive tax rates, our national tax rates, in the 1950s. The largest boom when we had very, very progressive tax rates. At this point right now, I look at Representative Rukavina's explanation of where the wealth lies. Members, in 1986, the average CEO made 52 times what the average worker made. In 2006, 20 years later, it was 252-1. Members, in 1960, that number was 8-1. We see where the wealth has been going in this nation. It's been going towards the top. And I think one of the points made earlier here is right, is that Representative Garofalo said, you know, you're concentrating the tax burden on a smaller and smaller section of the population. Members, that's because the wealth has all been going to that sector, increasingly so, over the course of the past 34 years. So I think this bill recognizes reality, and until we can more evenly distribute the income, whether it's through market forces or whether government has to do it, we have to take this action.
Representative Downey and Zellers. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, a few reactions to Representative Lesh's comments. I really find some of the demagoguery pretty offensive to highly offensive. And I think about my own circumstance personally as somebody who about 10 years ago switched from being an employee to a business owner. And the assertions about the character of people who employ others, that they're simply out to increase their wealth at the expense of others, is in large part, I think, out in business untrue, and I hope certainly for myself untrue. When I switched from being an employee to a business owner, I switched from somebody whose income was guaranteed to somebody who put a lot of their own personal capital at risk and whose annual income was always 100% at risk depending on how that business did. And I switched from somebody who simply collected a paycheck to somebody who paid a number of other people's paychecks and hired, just in the last 8 years myself, 20 individuals, started paying their salary, was paying their FICA, their FUTA, their SUTA, their unemployment compensation, writing $18,000 checks a year to match their 401k contributions, sitting on boards making contributions to philanthropic organizations, doing what I could in my community to leverage what I had earned on behalf of others. So I really think when the conversation degrades to the level that it is here, that it gets really personal for me, and I take offense at that, and I think we need to think about public policy as compared to demagoguing people, and I include myself in that category. So with that as a bit of a an intro, I do think we need to think from a public policy standpoint a little more clearly. This concept of from each according to his means to each according to his need that I'm hearing today has been proven.
Person who knows that quote, that was incorrect. From each according to his ability to each according to his needs. But anyway.
I don't know. Representative Downey.
Tax the rich and distribute to the poor. I understand the concept. And so anyway, that is an economic philosophy, I mean, has proven to result in disasters for nations, and I think we need to be looking at fairness of opportunity as compared to fairness of outcomes. So with that as my soapbox, let me just ask a basic question on the, and this may be for Mr. Michael or somebody from House Fiscal, on the revenue projections out in FY 2012 and 2013. I know when we had our discussion about changing the capital gains tax rate, we actually in our forecast modeled a decrease in the revenues that would be collected because there was clearly historical evidence of behavior changes that resulted in a reduction in the total revenue to government when we increased the capital gains rate and an increase in revenue to government when we subsequently reduced it. Was there any kind of modeling in this forecast here that tried to predict what behaviors might occur, especially with a blink on, blink off, and people's ability to kind of delay taking income? Was there any of that considered here, or was this just a straight-up kind of static calculation?
Okay, and so Representative Downey, I think the question would actually, it's the department who prepares the revenue estimate. If the department could address Representative Downey's question. And so I think Representative Downey, you're trying to find out if this is a static or dynamic model. No one's going to... Okay. We can ask Ms. Templin to join us, but really it's not. It's the department who creates the revenue estimate. But maybe Ms. Templin can, until maybe someone from the department's willing to come up. Ms. Templin.
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, this probably isn't the end-all comment, but I do know that all of these estimates are prepared based on the February forecast, and that is a static forecast.
Representative Downey. Yes, and I think that's important. Representative Downey is making a point there, and everyone should keep that in mind, that, you know, we sometimes members want us to look at some dynamic and some static, and we need to be consistent, and they're all static. So I think Representative Downey is making a point here that this bill, like all bills we hear, would have changes that may not be modeled.
Madam Chair, I think just to put a finer point on that, I think what Representative Downey is suggesting is I understand and appreciate that we use a static analysis. That's how we're going to book it if we do something like this. But you know, business owners and even some of those really not nice high-wage earners at corporations have the ability to negotiate with their employers about when they're going to get paid certain income. And so there certainly may be an opportunity for people to defer income until the time when we blink this off. And so while this may be what we book, and I understand how we're going to do the budgeting, I think there is a policy distinction that Representative Downey is raising that's important for members to consider.
Thank you. Representative West, yes, and then Zeller's Bill Downey. Representative
thank
West.
You. And thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Downey. On this committee, there's certainly plenty of indignation to go around. From all sectors, and from folks who go up on Rice Street or on Payne Avenue or Arcade or Maryland or into Representative Mulberry's district or some of the other districts here, with people who are hurting, who are getting their homes foreclosed on, who've lost jobs, sometimes it gets really difficult to see why things are as they are. I absolutely recognize running a business. I've run business before. I've had to make payrolls. And I understand that. And I think everyone around this table, while I can speak for myself, certainly appreciates the value of folks who are going to employ people. The concern that I've attempted to articulate is where the wealth has flowed, where it's not going back into the system the way that it's supposed to be designed. And that has caused me concern, and that's why I brought up the point. But, you know, this kind of conversation is probably going to be had continually over the course of the next couple of weeks, about why the current state of the economy is the way it is and what we can do about that. And nothing should be taken from me to indicate that because you're providing jobs, somehow you're a bad actor in Minnesota. Nothing could be further from the truth. But I just want to make sure we point out where the system is broken.
Okay, so Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, Representative Downey, as any good freshman, is who stole my question, so I only have a half a question left. My concern was as well, as we've seen in other models when we have these discussions during some of the overviews, you start taxing people again, because it's not just the rich, Representative Rutlesh, it's the job providers who, again, file as S-Corps, LLCs, LLPs, and file their business and their income taxes together. So it's not just you're going to tax a bunch of rich guys sitting around with bags of money next to them. You're taxing job providers, and that's the whole. We've made this point over and over again, so I won't belabor it. But Representative Rukabina, I won't thank you for bringing the bill up, because I don't think it's a good idea. But I will compliment you on being honest, and for at least you don't do what some of your colleagues are doing, which is tax the six pack and the booze that the people who, again, you and I are both trying to help, at least you're not going after that tax, because I think that's even more egregious in tough economic times. But the part that I guess a philosophical question for you, Representative Rukavina, you know, growing up in a lower middle-income family on a farm, the goal was always to do a little bit better, earn a little bit more, because that was the American dream. The harder you worked, the more opportunity there was for you, the more opportunity there would be for you the next day. And under your bill, the more money, again, a small business owner maybe hires from one employee to two employees or to three employees, under your bill, the more you achieve, the more you're penalized. That, and granted, that's just the way I see taxation, but I guess I'm just curious as to, you know, For those folks who do want to take a shot at the American dream, own their own business, start their own business, go out on their own, like Representative Downey said, go from signing the back of the check to the front of the check, you know, what to them, once you get to a certain level here, looks like it's a disincentive to produce.
Madam Chair,
let me just preface what I'm going to say by saying I like all you guys over there. I really do. We just have a different philosophy. And I didn't mean to imply, and I don't think Representative Lesh did, that anybody's a bad person because they make a fairly good income. But Representative Zellers, to your question, when I came here I got elected in 1986. My first session was 1987. Then a Iron Range governor by the name of Rudy Perpich wanted to conform with Ronald Reagan's tax laws. We went from, I believe it was 14 income tax brackets, or maybe Joel can help me. It was somewhere around there, which the highest, I think, was 15, close to 15%.
Mr. Michael?
At that time, it was, I'm sure, I think at that time, the top rate was 15.
Right. Down to, and the lowest one was 1 or 1.5%. And we confirmed, we went to two tax brackets, 6 and 8. Then in the Carlson, I think, administration, we went to 8.5. Maybe it was the end of purposes. I'm just trying to get back to what I think is fair taxes, and I have a different philosophy than you guys, but I still like you guys, and I really like Representative Downey, and I told him that because he serves on my committee. He's a nice guy. He's just wrong sometimes.
Okay, Representative Zellers,
yeah,
and Bill
the history, and I guess that's part of being on tax committee, as you remember the bills from, you know, how many years ago, and then recite them back. What I'm talking about is your bill going forward. If I start making, you know, say I get over that $250,000 threshold, there's a disincentive because I'm going to be taxed at a higher rate at 12% versus 10%. So if I'm a job provider and if I'm going to expand my business, hire more people, there's a chance that I may make more money then. I may lose more money too, but I may make more money. This is a disincentive. I mean, I'm going to pay more in taxes, so why wouldn't I just stay where I'm at, stay below the 250, not go above that? So we're never going to have, I guess, anybody looking to, you know, to build beyond. And for job providers, you know, that's the idea is to make more to build. And to Representative Lesch, you know, the demagoguery about our Minnesota companies, Minnesota nice companies, you know, the ability for our companies, I think you're confusing the state and federal tax code, but the ability of our Minnesota businesses to jump the border, to jump, you know, the mid-United States, get 3M to go down to Texas, you know, that's the part of it that, you know, I disagree with. I don't like it either, but what are we going to do? Complain about it, or are we going to do something about it? Now, this is more to your income, but I'm just curious as to why, as a business or a job provider, or even if you don't employ anybody, if you're a salesman, I'm going to stop my sales once I get to about $200,000 a year, because after I go over 250, I'm going to pay more.
Madam Chair,
Representative Rukavina.
Just to the committee quickly, I am asking anybody that earns income in the state of Minnesota to pay. Granted, I am doing it in different percentages, but I am asking anybody, the poorest of the poor, the person that hauls the beer around, that you don't want that sin tax any more than me, that maybe makes has an adjusted gross income 10-15 grand, they're going to still pay under this. I'm asking everybody that earns income to pay, number one. Number two, Representative Zellers, you look me in the eye, please. I've asked you to do this before, and you tell me that there aren't going to be, if we don't raise income fairly, that we're not going to raise it through some property tax increases on local government level, and that are going to be really, really, really regressive and unfair. Look me in the eye and tell me that isn't going to happen if we don't raise some revenue.
$100.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And again, back to the same conversation we've had. At the local level, if the local governments decide to raise property taxes, I have no faith in Hennepin County not to raise my property taxes.
And Madam Chair, that's the issue. Is it fair, then? Representative Zellers, well, then you come up then with a way that you think it's fair. I'm coming. You guys have said, you all know we got to raise revenue to get out of this session. You did it. Your Governor Pawlenty did it with a cigarette fee, something he called a fee, you know, that's been a tax for 100 years, got called a fee.
Yep.
On the poorest of the poor, we all know who smokes, 75 cents a pack. Now we're looking at all these sins. Well, you know what? Where I come from, the biggest sin is greed. Maybe it's not right. Maybe that's a bad philosophy. But there's a lot of greedy people that caused the mess we're in. And they aren't that guy that hauls that beer around and that always be looked at because of a sin tax. So I'm just trying to do a non-sin tax. That's all.
$10.
No. Well, thanks, Madam Chair. And Representative Rukavina, you're right. We have a fundamental disagreement on...
But we still like each other.
We still like each other, and each time my daughter comes down here, you try to make her say the word Democrat over and over again. So if nothing else, you're persistent, Representative Rukavina, in everything that you do, and I thank you for that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Joe Dabney-Leaving. Representative Joe.
Well, thank you, Chair Lynchefsky, and since Representative Zellers is sitting right next to me, I can just so disagree with what he just said in his testimony. And, you know, what we're talking about fair, and then we're talking about what's right. And, I mean, it's not right when our kids go to school and they can't get a foreign language. It's not right on the Iron Range when the kids make a living in the woods logging and they make a living at the iron mines and we don't have any industrial arts. And we don't have when our librarian is only 0.5 in our local school, but the kids go for a full day in school. It's not right when we throw out when we don't fund our nursing homes to the level to take care of the people that are our seniors that got us to where we're at. And I hope I got on the tax committee. I got on the tax committee because I thought I would have a better understanding of why I'm getting taxed and why the job providers in my district are getting taxed. Frankly, I haven't learned much about that here because all we do is fight about what's fair and what's supposedly right. And I'll tell you what the job providers are really thinking, because you know that I'm one of them. Why are you bothering me with charging me $5,000 or $6,000 in more income tax on what I'm earning, from what I heard Representative Cole say? Why are you bothering me? I just want it to be, I don't want my property taxes to go up quite as much as they have, 30.1% this year, 30.1%. I don't want my hospital district to raise my property taxes $400 on my house this year because they aren't getting it reimbursed from the state. I don't want my wife to come home from school and say that she's volunteering the half of the day. She still goes to school at 7:30 in the morning, and she still gets home at 4:30 at night, but she only gets half a paycheck. I mean, she doesn't need the paycheck, but the point is that somebody does, and she's on half time. Why are you bothering me over $5,000? I'm worried about making the next deal and making $100,000, and if representatives are more than that, hopefully, if Representative Zellers is going to tell me that I'm going to stop at $250,000 because I might get charged $5,000 more, what planet are you folks on? I mean, realistically, I'm going to look at that and say, well, I'm just going to make $500,000 then, and you can charge me some more. It's about the art of the deal. That's what it's about. That's how entrepreneurs and job creators think. It's the art of the deal. It's the pursuit of success. And the fact that you charge for taxes, there's nothing holding me in Minnesota, except I live here for a reason. It's because of what Minnesota has to offer. I can move to Sioux Falls. I can move to Grand Forks. My son just bought a house in Grand Forks. He's in college over there. He said, Dad, move over here. You can get a year-round hunting license instead of that damn 10-day license that Minnesotans get, and you don't have to pay any income taxes. And then he thinks about it a little bit, and he says, you know, I can't live on the lake where I live in the summer when I come home from school if we do that. So don't bother me with the small stuff. Show me the way out of the woods to get to the big stuff, and I'll pay my way along the way. So I'm not stopping at 250, Kurt.
Can I just say, God, I love that capitalist.
Okay, Representative Downey, then leave links. Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, thank you. I actually heard some grounds for consensus here. And I think, yeah, Representative Downey's laughing, but I think it was you, Representative Downey. You talked about wanting fairness of opportunity. And I think that's where we could probably find a fair amount of consensus in this room. The challenge, I got on the list, I think, last week when Representative Garofalo was talking. But,
That was about a month ago.
That was about a month ago, yeah. And he was rhetorically pounding the table asking about the fairness. So where's the fairness? This isn't fair. Well, I think it's hard to talk about fairness when we're only looking at half of the ledger. Mm-hmm. Because somebody's going to pay for this budget deficit. And either it's going to be some form of hopefully progressive taxation, or the folks who are going to pay are going to be the kids in the public schools, as Representative Dill has touched on. It's going to be the folks who rely on some state assistance for their child care so they can get up and go to work in the morning. It's going to be the folks who are going to lose their jobs because of public sector cuts. That'll start with the cuts to the state agencies. Then it'll go to the cities and counties when we cut local government aid and similar programs. Then it'll go to the nonprofit sector because so much of the health care that and health and human services programs we provide, the state doesn't provide directly. We do through any number of nonprofits. Then the cumulative effect of the rising unemployment in the public and nonprofit sectors will hit the private sector, because the folks walking on Main Street will have less in their pockets to spend on Main Street. It'll be born in our low-income communities, through less job training and opportunities. Somebody's going to pay for this. And if we only look at one side of the ledger, it's harder to find the fairness. But I think of my grandmother, who is the first one in her family born in this country, born on a farm outside of Pelican Rapids when the family came over from Norway. and who became a business owner later. And as a business owner, she relied on what the state provides for the success of her business. Rule of law, courts and police. She relied on an education system, K-12 and higher education, to prepare the workers. She relied on streets and roads prepared and by the public sector. That's what job providers get for the taxes they pay. And grandmother went to church every Sunday and raised her family to remember that to whom much has been given, much is expected. Not bad, Grandma.
Representative Dilden Liebling. Representative Dill.
Well, I wanted to just add a very short piece. If you really want to do something that's going to help businesses, like I said, don't bother me with the $5,000 on the $500,000. Worry about streamlining regulations. Make permitting processes more rapidly. Take out the litigious nature of the permitting process. Do things that make it easier for Minnesotans to achieve, and then I'll let them pay on the other end. And I also think that I don't want to pay more than 7.85% in the future, but I'm willing to pay a blink on in the temporary to solve this problem. You know, if your septic system, if you wake up in the morning and your toilet backs up, you got to do something about it. So you call up the guy and you have your septic system pumps, you may even have to repair it. You have to pay. You might have to borrow money at the bank to do it and put in a new mortgage on your house to do it. That's where we're at in this budget right now. As our septic system's backed up, we got to pump the thing and fix it. And we got to find some money to do it. And we may have to borrow a little bit from somebody along the way. So make it easier to do business in Minnesota.
I hope that wasn't an analogy for the bill, man.
Representative Liebling.
All right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. A lot of good things have been said. I want to kind of go back to this, what Representative Downey started to talk about. You know, I think it's really not necessary to demonize anybody here. But I really don't want to demonize people who are making a lot of money because, you know, in every group there's people that are doing everything for the right reasons and some people that aren't. And we're going to find that across every occupation, across every income level, let's face it, you know. That's just the way human nature is. But I also don't like this language. We've got to be careful that we don't do this on either side. When Representative Colson, you talk about attacking and going after people. You know, nobody here wants to attack and go after anybody, although maybe sometimes the rhetoric gets a little that way. But we're all in this really big problem that Representative Garofalo was talking about. And Representative Dabney's right. When you make cuts, that hurts the economy, too. You know, I know a lot of times, you know, the Republican members here are worried about if we raise the taxes on the wealthiest people, we'll hurt the economy, they'll stop creating jobs, they'll move away and all that. But the reverse is true, too. That, you know, we're not in a vacuum here where it's raise taxes or don't do anything. We got to either, you know, we're going to have to make cuts anyway. Let's face it. Even with this, I was just adding this, what the bill, this bill has, Representative Rukavina, this bill not quite gets us to our committee target, I think, if I'm looking at this right, if we were going to do just this. But even with that, we're making some really serious cuts to get through this, to get this budget together. So, I mean, things are pretty ugly, but, you know, we're going to have to do this one way or another. And we're not trying to attack and go after anybody. Not on the tax side, not on the cut side. The reality is we've got to do a lot of pretty awful stuff, and how are we going to do it that has the least total harm to our state and the most fairness, however we conceive of that. So I just hope that we can kind of keep that rhetoric under control and stop talking about the job creators. I really don't like that language either because, you know what, when people spend money, they're creating jobs too. You know, they're creating jobs at the mall when they're going out and spending money at the mall. So, you know, people that don't make that much money and don't own businesses also are creating jobs with their dollars. And the fact that they're not spending now is creating a lot of the problem that we're in. So that's what I wanted to say.
Thank you. Representative
Loeffler. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think it's been an interesting discussion, and I totally
agree with the progressive nature of the proposal before us, but we spent most of our time talking about the impacts on the top end, and I think we have to worry about the impacts on the bottom end as well with the people who earn under $30,000. And I think we need to weigh that as we move forward as well, because those are the people who are disproportionately going to absorb the fee increases and the cuts that are going to result from decisions made in other committees in this building, and by local city councils who decide to add new street lighting fees that won't be assisted by our property tax refund credit, who will be hit by other provisions that we have put together, who disproportionately are represented on the 5,000 people who are already waiting for services who happen to have a child with developmental disabilities, or the persons who have lost a wage earner because of a car accident or some other catastrophic thing that put them on the 650-person current waiting list for traumatic brain injury assistance. And those people, I think, have a really limited ability to both absorb the cuts that are going to get passed on as well as the increases. And so I hope as this moves forward, we'll look at whether or not that lowest income, how they're getting hit, not just in this committee with potential tax decisions, but also with the other committees as they're doing their work, because I think they're the area that we have traditionally protected, and some of our old tools like the property tax refund just don't work anymore as our cities and counties have followed our lead in adding fees to every service that they provide.
Thank you. Public testimony for or against this bill. Further committee discussion. We still have one more bill, members. And members, I do want to add to this discussion as well. Just to put this in perspective, Representative Kamar had an income tax increase bill. We've heard that. We just heard Representative Rukavina's. We're going to hear some others. The House budget shifts or transfers $1.8 billion. The governor shifts or transfers $2.6 billion. The House is going to raise, this committee, $1.5 billion in taxes. The governor raises a new $1 billion in revenue. It's a half a billion off on revenue between the House and the governor. The governor cuts $1.5 billion. The House cuts $1.6 billion. So when we're all thinking about this, the House is actually going to propose larger cuts than the governor is in his budget. And so when people are concerned that everyone shares in this, there is no doubt that all Minnesotans are going to share in this. And I guess I just want to say that when we know the finance chairs, the appropriations chairs, are going to make sure that those in the least affluent position in the Minnesota economy and those who are not even able to earn income to be in the income tax system, and then those who are in the bottom bracket and those who are at the middle bracket, those finance chairs are going to hammer those people. So no one needs to worry that low and middle income Minnesotans are going to get hurt. They're going to. All the fiscal chairs have cuts for their targets or zeros. So if anybody's worried that somehow just the affluent are going to get hurt in the House budget, the 15 fiscal chairs will tell you different. Because when they take things away from Minnesotans through cuts, they're taking them from those who need help the most. So in my estimation, whether it's this method or another one, my intent is to try to put together some progressive change in revenue because we know, and it isn't class warfare, but we know that the finance and appropriation chairs are going to cut low and middle income Minnesotans. And one way to ensure a shared sacrifice is really on the revenue side, to have those who really won't be harmed by the cuts contribute to the situation Minnesota finds itself in. Mr. Hesse, you wanted to testify on this bill.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I thought twice about coming down, but I figured I should at least put on the record that the Minnesota Chamber does oppose increases in personal income taxes. As you know, many small businesses, S-Corps, partnerships, limited liability companies, sole proprietors, flow their business income through their personal return. So this is an increase that small business owners will feel. With that, I'll be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Further public testimony for or against the bill. Further questions for the committee? Representative Rukavina, thank you so much. We're going to lay your bill over for possible inclusion on the omnibus tax bill. Thank you. And Representative Mullery now moves House File 2120.
Thank you, Madam Chair. About 50 minutes ago, apparently, I fell asleep, and I thought I was in either Hyde Park or DuPont Circle, but I forgot my soapbox. So.
Thank you. That was already.
Madam Chair, and members, this bill is part of the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act. Most of the states in the upper Midwest have adopted this. It's the throwback sales rule. As you know, we keep pushing more and more of our corporate and business taxes and taking account of where the sales are. And this basically just has so that businesses can't get away without paying some tax by taxing those sales that have no taxable site, or it's called nexus under the technical legal term. So they can't be taxed in another state, and then also the federal government is often can't be taxed that way because we don't know where the actual destination of the sales are. And then it also picks up sales of services if the greater portion of the services is performed here in Minnesota. So,
thank you. Questions for Representative Mueller? I think members have been on this committee a while, know what the throwback is. I wonder if Mr. Hesse is still waiting around. testimony for or against House Bill 2120? Please.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I just want to make a couple of quick points. Throwback rules generally really hurt small and medium-sized companies. If you think about a typical small company that has most, if not all, of its property and payroll in Minnesota and sells to customers outside the state, those sales, the company will typically not have nexus in those states where it sells outside of the state. So all those sales will be thrown back to Minnesota, which will increase its apportionment percentage and its tax that it pays in Minnesota. A throwback bill also offsets Minnesota's tradition of heavily weighting the sales factor. Even as far back as 1939, Minnesota heavily weighted its sales factor in its apportionment formula, giving manufacturers a 70% sales weighting. In 1953, the option was extended to all firms, and in 2000, it was bumped up to 75% sales weighting, and now we're moving towards 100% sales weighting over a several-year period. Adding a throwback rule now dilutes the impact of going to single sales factor apportionment because you're putting in more sales into the numerator of the formula, but then again diluting the impact that it has. Maybe one just quick example, and I know this will be simple, but it might demonstrate what this could do to a small company. If you assume that a company has 100% of its property and payroll in Minnesota, 50% of its sales in Minnesota, 50% in Wisconsin. The apportionment percentage under current law, and I think the sales weighting right now is 80%, but it's changing. I just used 80% because the math was easy. That would result in 60% of the company's net income would be taxable in Minnesota. If we moved to a throwback rule, 100% of its net income would be taxable in Minnesota, so a 67% increase in its tax liability. If you change the assumptions to that company having 75% of its sales in Minnesota, 25% in Wisconsin, then it only is a 25% increase in that company's tax liability. Still significant, and that's why we think this is a really bad approach for the corporate income tax for small and medium-sized companies. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Further public testimony. Rep. Samari.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but that's just a good example of how you can make up figures to show anything you want. If that same company, if two companies were likewise and one had a branch in Wisconsin, one didn't, we've heard at the Hyde Pike here era about fairness all the time, you'd be treating totally different under his version. So if they really want fairness and what they were arguing for the sales tax factor, then this is a good proposal.
Thank you. Further discussion from the committee. Further public testimony. Yes, please. We all have to get to the floor here, so we're trying to get out of here as soon as we can, members, so we don't have to meet tonight. Welcome, Ms. Cadoon.
Madam Chair, Beth Cadoon with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I just wanted to briefly say, it's highlighted on the revenue analysis as well, is that the Department of Revenue just has some concerns regarding some of the definitions that are in the bill. We believe some of these really need some sharper definitions, such as taxpayer, how that's defined, if it's entity by entity basis or unitary group. So just some of those terms really need some further definition if this bill moves forward.
Okay. Thank you. Further discussion? If not, we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Lesh moves the minutes of April 7th. Discussing the amendments, the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. The amendments are adopted. We are adjourned. The minutes are adopted.